Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. What shall we talk about? Oh, yeah, the big election. Yeah, that thing that happened yesterday. Maybe talk a little bit about the voter suppression, the intimidation, some of the problems, some of the glitches, some of the things that went wrong and how we fixed them. And also, what problems we're going to face from this day forward, how do we solve those? How do we make sure that the cliff that they've set up for us to go over, the hostage situation that has been created and, well, we're steaming towards, how do we make sure we stop that? And, well, what would be the negative effects? What will happen if gridlock continues? Because, you know, a lot of folks are saying the status quo was elected last night. If you look at the House, not much change. So what's going to happen? What's going to go? Are we going to see a repeat of the last 2 years? That will be very interesting. I'm curious your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Where do you see this whole thing going? So did Karl Rove have a bad night last night? Was he off his game, as some people say? Well, the excuses are rampant. Evidently, Newt claims he was wrong. And, you know, a lot of people out there saying Mitt wasn't conservative enough. Oh, it was the hurricane. You've got other conservatives saying, oh, wow, you know, Mitt's economic plan was not free market enough. It was too tough on China, I heard some folks say. Lindball this morning talking about that he was ticked off that voters remembered the collapse in 2008 was because of Bush policies, conservative policies. And, of course, Glenn Beck thought that God really sucks sometimes. Kind of a very interesting thought. But not surprising, given how insane some of this stuff has been. It's been fun to watch. The reality is the game is over. Obama won 303-206. And, you know, there's going to be none of that. Well, you know, he lost the, no, he won the popular vote. Over 60 million votes. To the 57 million that Romney had. So now we can move forward. Unless you're someone who watches fake news on Fox. And one of the more bizarre things that I heard, and this is, again, this Kill Meat guy is someone who I think that really just needs to get smacked. Evidently it's his belief that, you know, since they believe that the hurricane was the October surprise. But evidently Kilmeade believes that we're the shallowest nation in the history of man. Because on the exit polling, some people considered Hurricane Sandy, how the rescue efforts and how we came together and how everything operated, considered that a factor. Considering how the president handled it, how his government, how the people that he appointed didn't do the brownie thing, that the president didn't, you know, fly over and play guitar and eat cake on a tarmac somewhere, that they actually immediately got to it. So somehow, we're the shallowest country in the history of man, according to Mr. Kilmeade. Yeah. But I guess, you know, you gotta have something, right? You've gotta attack something. What I found interesting is all of the excuses, and I've been kind of collecting the excuses today, and they are as varied as we are in this nation. And for me, it comes down to the pure and simple fact that I think Obama just ran a better campaign, a much better campaign. People are seeing that, you know what, in 2008, we were in a deep hole, and we've been digging out slowly, building on success, and slowly moving forward. And I look at the campaign that he ran and the message that he ran on, and I go, you know, maybe had Al Gore or John Kerry run a campaign that was comparable, maybe this nation wouldn't be in the mess that it's in. You know, maybe in 2000 had Al Gore actually run a campaign like this where you had the thing that I've always given Obama's campaigns credit for is the second something hits, it's answered. There's a response. And if you go back to John Kerry with the whole Swift boat thing, where he's out jet skiing around, that allowing that to fester. I give Obama credit for running good campaigns. And for me, this is what these elections should be about. not about who can raise the most money, but who operates the best campaign, who can bring in the most volunteers, who can mobilize people. And I found it one of the more interesting things I saw today was, you know, CNN was, they had a panel that, you know, talking to Obama and that what Obama should do. And one of the suggestions was to appoint Romney as Secretary of Business. And the rationale behind it was, well, he made Hillary Clinton Secretary of State because, you know, you got to keep your enemies close. You know, you got to keep them real close. So make Mittens the Secretary of Business. Or put him in charge of Treasury, since I guess Geithner's going. And, you know, as I was thinking, I was going, wow, that's kind of an interesting thought. The only problem is Obama's not going to run again. So I can understand the argument of pulling Hillary in because you don't want her to run in the next election against you. You don't want to be primaried. I get that. But he's never going to run for another office. Just a thought. So the questions that I have going forward and the things we're going to be looking at over the next couple of months is, you know, can a leopard change its spots? I mean, can we see the parties change? I mean, will the Republicans be willing to compromise on any of the pledges, any of the lines in the sand that they've drawn, any of these? If you listen to Boehner today, man, still standing behind that line. Or are you going to see the Democrats cave? I mean, I'm already hearing about the grand bargain, the big compromise, which, for me, when you start talking about first clubs out of the bag going after Social Security and first clubs out of the bag going after the safety net, I got a problem with that. For me, there's a hierarchy. Like in any family, and I liked Obama's victory speech last night. I think, you know, he talked about a lot of things that we've talked about on this program. We may differ on the path we take to get to the end of the road, which is we want safe neighborhoods, good schools. We want a secure retirement. We want health security. We want those things that make up the American dream. I think we all want basically the same thing. The question is, which roads do you take to get there? And, you know, now is the time where we need to be figuring out in that hierarchy, you know, like a diverse family, who carries the most water? You know, and I think about my family. If I'm to take the Republican view of, you know, everyone's gotta equally pay taxes, and we're gonna raise taxes on everybody, and everyone's gonna pay, my 4-year-old would have to pay in our family. You know, I think about my wife and I think about my 3 kids and you go, okay, well, I've got the biggest shoulders. I'm the one who's able to carry the most water. When we go, when we carry in the groceries, for instance, who carries the most bags? Well, I do. And then my wife, and then down the line, the people with the biggest shoulders carry the most weight. And you look at our economy right now, and that's kind of my worldview. You know, if we're all in this together and we all are moving in the same direction and we're all looking for that American dream, well, who do we ask for the most from? Well, those who've been given the most, those who are able to carry the biggest load. Don't you think? Or am I off base here? So my 4-year-old should be carrying on all the groceries and I can, you know, just point. Is that the idea? Well, I sure hope not. But, you know, you look at this, and we're going to hear a lot about the fiscal cliff. We're going to hear a lot about the Bush tax code and all this over the next couple of months. And you look at yesterday, Boehner told Political that he said, quote, we're not raising taxes on small business people. He pointed to this Ernst & Young study. Then he said, Ernst & Young made it clear it's going to cost our economy 700,000 jobs. Why in the world do we want to do that? Because, hey, we don't want to raise taxes on wealthy people. And he has conflated small business people with millionaires and billionaires, which you got to give them credit. At least they stick to their tactic. Understand, the vast majority, like in the 90%, 90-95% range of small business people do not make $250,000 a year or more. I know a lot of small business people. I don't know any of them that bring home in their pocket $250,000. I just don't. And I know no one who makes over $1 million. So when you put these two together, as they do so well, and to use the Ernst & Young study, which has been discredited and contradicted by numerous sources, and you look at the Congressional Research Service report that the Republicans made them pull offline, that said, look, there's no correlation between economic growth and lowering the top tax rate. In fact, it's the other way around. It creates a larger gulf between those who have so much and those who have, well, not so much. And I know, I hear my Republicans go, oh, you want equals, you want distribution of wealth, you want everybody to have this. No, I don't want everyone to have the same. But the reality is there should not be, and it's not good for democracy, where you have an elite aristocrat who has unlimited resources to be able to spend $100 million on a campaign, and folks who, well, one in six, as the Republicans were running around saying, people who are living in poverty who need food stamps. There's something wrong with the economy. There's something wrong with the way the system is working for everybody. And I know over the next couple of months we're going to hear, and I've been saying for a while, the tax reform bill of 86 is going to be the template for what they try and ram down our throats over the next several months. Again, this idea that we're going to lower tax rates, cut loopholes. We've seen this movie. This is a repeat. We've seen it before. We've seen it a couple of times. It doesn't work. You know what works? High tax rates and incentives. Pretty simple. We've been there. We've seen the movie. The question is will the people who we've put into power, again, most people are saying the status quo, are they going to continue the Grover Norquist, we need to cut taxes at all costs, or are we going to see some movement towards, you know what, at least returning to the Clinton tax code, which I'm in favor of, for everybody. And later on when we talk to Dr. Stephen Herzenberg about the fiscal cliff, I'm going to ask about that. You know, what does that mean? Because if I remember the Clinton years were pretty good. We were creating jobs. There was prosperity. Something I wouldn't mind going back to. But if you listen to Boehner, you listen to the talk that's come out of them, it's the exact same thing that they were pushing before. There's no lesson learned here. Nothing whatsoever. So the question is what issues are we going to be facing? There's, of course, the middle class tax hike we're going to have to look at. The payroll tax cut is expiring at the first. The debt ceiling, we're going to have a problem with that again. Austerity, more austerity, lots of things to be talking about. We're going to take some of that today. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO today will release national election night polling and detail the labor movement's massive voter mobilization efforts. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka and Political Committee Chair AFSCME President Lee Saunders will also outline how working people plan to hold elected officials accountable to continue rebuilding a middle-class economy. Key findings from voters will be highlighted in the first post-election poll by Hart Research Associates. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says labor political activists knocked on 5.5 million doors and made 5.2 million phone calls during labor's final four-day push to get out the vote. Trumka said that effort was important for President Obama, especially in Ohio and Wisconsin. This election year, labor welcomed activists from organizations like MoveOn.org and Planned Parenthood to multiply its outreach capacity beyond union households. A new six-year labor contract for 1,500 flight attendants at Pinnacle Airlines was ratified by the workers on Tuesday. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the agreement preserves wages, protects affordable health care, and provides job security. The agreement also includes $6.4 million in concessions demanded by management in the bankruptcy restructuring process at the airline. The union doesn't like the agreement, but ratified it with help from the National Mediation Board in an effort to minimize the impact on flight attendants. Meanwhile, a union representation election has been scheduled for 9,700 passenger service agents at American Airlines. Voting instructions are being mailed in December, and the results will be counted January 15th. Wisconsin continues to feel the repercussions of returning $810 million in stimulus money for high-speed...
Manufacturer Talgo had opened a plant in the state thanks to the rail funding. But when Governor Scott Walker took office, he returned the funding to the government, citing costs of upkeep as the reason for rejecting the money. That decision left Talgo in an awkward position due to an additional contract it had with the state to also build passenger trains for Amtrak's Hiawatha line. It was the necessity to build these remaining contracted trains that prevented the company from packing up and leaving the state completely after the high-speed rail money was lost. The company kept 125 workers in place to complete that contract. Talgo now alleges that the state has refused to put the trains in operation and is also refusing to pay millions of dollars it still owes for them. The case has gone to court, and if the state loses, it'll also lose out on $50 million spent on the project. The state responded to Talgo's allegations by saying that the trains don't meet basic federal standards and that Talgo had failed to do proper testing. In a strongly worded statement, Talgo CEO Antonio Perez said, "I don't see how any company would in the future choose to do business with the state of Wisconsin when the state has shown it cannot be trusted to honor contracts that it signed."
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
You know, that's going to be one of those clips that stick around for quite a while. Nice prediction there. And, well, you know, didn't work out quite the way he had planned. Our tweet of the day comes from Steve Miskin, which he says in the, with a little photo of reporters looking a little bored, he writes, "In the PA Capitol newsroom briefing reporters about issues, elections, and other brilliant things only reporters ask." And, you know, you find out what was went on during that briefing. Where Sam Smith said, quote, I'm saying 90% of the precincts turning out in 90% of the voters is questionable. He says, "I know counties where the people work their tail off trying to get people to come out and vote, and they don't hit 90% in 90% of the precincts." Vince Hughes, who is the Democratic senator, stood up and said, "You know what? It's outrageous, it's offensive, and it's borderline racist," the comments that he made. And you think about it, you know, if the 90% number that he was touting was true, in 90% of the districts, it's been reported that you would have seen a turnout of more than 80%, which in Philadelphia only saw 60%. So not quite sure where Sam Smith's getting his numbers, but kind of makes you wonder. I mean, you gotta love the Twitters. I've got our good friend attorney Erwin Aronson on the line. He was one of the poll watchers, one of the attorneys making sure that our vote is well protected. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here. How are you?
I am good. So House Speaker Sam Smith, you know, kind of stepping in a little bit, saying, you know, some questionable things in Philadelphia, which seems to be the Republican hardline.
Well, you know, I listened to Minority Leader in the U.S. Senate, Mitch McConnell, last night, and in the face of among the most stunning national defeats that has ever been seen in one election cycle, Mitch McConnell called out the President of the United States, who made among the most conciliatory speeches I've ever heard, and said, in effect, "We're going to stay on this line to deny you a second term, even though you just won a second term."
Yeah.
And we have others, like Speaker Smith, refusing to accept the result that the people who they tried to keep from voting, the people whose votes they suppressed, the people whose votes they delayed, the people who have really been faced with a modern-day equivalent of the literacy test and the poll tax, nonetheless came out, exercised their franchise, participated in democracy, and I suspect that there's a great deal of resentment on the part of a lot of conservatives who were engaged in the process of denying democracy to part of our country, to part of our population, to part of our community, because it didn't work. And it didn't work for a host of reasons, from people reading, hearing, seeing, and learning about the assault on their most basic of rights, and saying hell no to unions in this state and in Ohio, in Indiana, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Florida, even in North Carolina, working harder than I've ever seen. I've seen them work plenty hard in many years in the past, to a crackerjack team of voter protection lawyers that I was proud to be associated with and coordinating throughout Pennsylvania and throughout several parts of the United States in our battleground states, along with the AFL-CIO and the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO voter protection team, and the ACLU and the NAACP and the League of Women Voters and in Philadelphia, the Committee of 70, and a number of other faith-based and public commitment-based organizations that collectively engaged in a stratospheric, nonpartisan voter protection, election protection activity that allowed people to exercise their franchise without a great deal of impediment. There were some. And did everything from finding where people were allowed to vote and should be voting to assuring that they weren't harassed in exercising their franchise to bringing them coffee when they were standing around for hours on end in those long lines that were artificially created and contrived, secondary to a host of things we learned about yesterday, not just the voter ID law, but that was enough.
Yeah, and I listened to the president's victory speech last night, and, you know, he talked about those long lines, something that we do need to fix, something we need to be looking, working towards as we move forward.
Well, we need to deal with some reality. In Pennsylvania, for example, where our population in several areas, including, for example, Dauphin and Cumberland counties in central Pennsylvania, York County in central Pennsylvania, the collar counties around Philadelphia, Delaware, Montgomery, Bucks, and Chester, where the populations have grown, we still have the same number of voting machines that we had based on a census that is more than a decade old, actually more than 12 years old. So the number of machines is inadequate to the growing population to begin with. And then we season that with this contemptuous judicial order that says the voter ID law doesn't apply, except we're going to have everybody be slowed down and asked for an ID anyway. So we have too few machines. We have extra people at the polls interfering really with right to vote by asking, and in many cases through the day yesterday, we found that they weren't merely asking or offering, but demanding that people show an ID. Slowing the lines down even further, and then to sort of cap it off, and we're investigating what I'm going to tell you next, and I'm actually revealing it to you first on this show, you and our listeners together. For the first time in all the years that I've been doing this Election Day voter protection work, in the field and in the boiler rooms and in the design phase, we had an extraordinary number all over the state of people who had registered to vote, typically by way of motor voter when they got a new or replaced driver's license and they have a box to check to indicate that they're registering to vote or changing the address of their registration. Just extraordinary numbers, but predominantly in the urban areas and in several instances, the heavily populated exurban areas in the state, where people who had been registered to vote, voting for years, in fact, found that their local judge of election had no record of them being a registered voter. And while I could go on my computer in our boiler room and find out within about 12 to 15 seconds whether an individual was indeed on the master voter registration rolls in Pennsylvania just by having a first and last name and a date of birth, people were being compelled to stand around for 20 and 30 minutes and longer in many, many polling places simultaneously to have a judge of elections check on that, slowing things down even further. And in just a shocking number of instances, Rick, people who knew they were registered to vote, who indeed had a driver's license issued by PennDOT, based upon that series of events that I described to you, with a correct address and all, were being told that they weren't registered to vote and were forced to cast provisional ballots at their regular polling places. And too much of it happened in Pennsylvania, and at the same time happened in Ohio, happened in Indiana, happened in Wisconsin, for us to accept without question that this was just an unintentional glitch. So we're tracking that down, and we're going to try to find out whether or not there was something more. And if there was, we know what to do.
Yeah. You know, I saw a report earlier that said that Pennsylvania had the second highest number of complaints, of concerns about, you know, as you pointed out, the provisional ballots, you know, the being challenged at polling places and things like that.
Well, we were ready for it. We read their playbook, and we had some of our best lawyers stationed at polling places in Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia, in Allentown, in Erie, and in Northampton, Bethlehem, where we knew to anticipate True the Vote and the Tea Party crowd trying to further interfere with, intimidate, and impede voter rights. And we had our lawyers well-trained. As you knew, virtually every weekend for the last 2 months, I've been training lawyers all over Pennsylvania and in other states, and we had a lot of we were blessed, really, in Pennsylvania with a number of lawyers from the Maryland and D.C. area who came north and worked for us in Dauphin, Cumberland, and York, and Adams County, and a number of lawyers, even in the face of last week's storms, from New Jersey and New York, many of whom had lost virtually everything they had, who nonetheless came to Pennsylvania to give us an able assist out in the Lehigh Valley area and in Stroudsburg and up closer towards Scranton and Wilkes-Barre. Not to advocate for any particular candidates or any particular political party, but just to assure that people had the right to exercise their franchise. It was an extraordinary operation, one of which I'm very proud, as I said, and one that protected people's right to vote. Not as Democrats, not as Republicans, but as citizens and as Pennsylvanians.
You know, I go back to the Speaker Sam Smith's statement about, you know, it being questionable that 90%, and he's wrong with the numbers, but, you know, when I read that, my first question is, why can't we get 90% of the people to the polls? Why can't we make it easier? Why can't we expand it? We've got the technology. We've got the ability to do just, we can put someone on the moon. Why can't we get people to vote?
Well, more importantly, I don't understand why, as a public official, as the Speaker of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, not the Republican or the Democratic House of Representatives, he wouldn't be celebrating the day that 90% of our eligible citizens actually voted. Well, that should be a cause for celebration, for joy, for recognition of the efficacy of our system and our democracy, not one to demean and belittle and question whether or not something happened. Intriguingly enough, and I've said this before on this show, the one very clearly non-existent form of fraud in balloting is that notion of in-person voter impersonation at the polls on Election Day. That's the one that the state, of course, stipulated in our litigation that they wouldn't even put evidence forward on because they couldn't point to one instance of it happening. But all the other fraud, and if I'm to accept what was uttered by people who were claiming shock at an alleged 90% voter turnout or even a 60% voter turnout, what they're telling us is that their fraud plan failed. Their plan to scare people away, take people away, drive people away, didn't work. And that the people, the citizens, the registered voters, the working men and women of Pennsylvania, people of color, people of Latino backgrounds, were not dissuaded from voting, but were encouraged and redoubled their resolve to come out and vote. That's a cause for a public official, Democrat or Republican, urban or rural, black or white, to rejoice.
Yeah, unless you're part of the folks who don't want that. I mean, because to be honest,
if you don't want that, you don't deserve to be in public office.
Well, I mean, if you look at the voter registration in this state, I mean, he's got, as a Republican, he knows more people vote, he loses.
Well, that's that clip you've played so many times from that right-wing lunatic fringe player of some years ago, Wyrick, who told the world, according to Wyrick, that we don't want people to vote. We lose elections if people actually vote.
Yeah, well, here it is.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
I think that's very, very clear right there. So let me ask you, you know, in the last couple minutes here, you know, where do we go from here? How do we make sure that these problems in the future get fixed? As the president said, the long lines, we fix that problem. The delays, the intimidation. How do we make sure that stuff stops?
Well, part of it is by showing those who would intimidate us, those who would coerce us, those who would drive us away and try to drive us out of the political arena. They can't do it. That it's just not marginally successful for them. And we did that yesterday.
Yep.
And part of it is we are rapidly coming to a time when the notion of casting ballots for such important offices and such important decisions cannot be relegated to a 13-hour period on a cold day in November every 4 years. I've been thinking about this problem for quite some time, going back to 2001 when I was blessed to be a candidate for the Commonwealth Court of Pennsylvania. And we do so many other things, make so many other secure transactions by alternative means. And in other states, we have engaged in this process of early voting in Ohio with early voting. To be sure, the governor of Ohio tried to tamp it down, tried to eliminate it, tried to back it off. We have it in Florida, and that governor, Rick Scott, shut things down, tied things up, bottled things up. But we found that in states where there's early voting, people voted in big numbers. My mother-in-law and father-in-law stood in line for 5 hours Sunday a week ago in Boca Raton, Florida, in order to cast their ballots. But what was different, of course, is that with all of the statutory changes in Florida, the reason that they and so many others did exactly that was because if there was a problem, if there was a flaw, if there was an inadequate ID, they'd have another chance between that Sunday and the following Tuesday, 10 days later, to repair those issues. Pennsylvania doesn't have that, and I think that that's something we need to deal with.
Yep.
And it may be that we need to liberalize here in Pennsylvania the access that people have to absentee ballots. Pennsylvania has a very narrow permissibility for absentee ballots. Only in two instances may someone get an absentee ballot. One is an illness that makes the polling place inaccessible, and the other is where business or personal commitment requires that the voter be away from the voting district on election day. Other states are much more permissive, if you will, with allowing people to exercise this most fundamental of rights.
And it's something we should be moving to expand, not restrict. Erwin, I appreciate all the work that you do, and thanks for talking to us.
Well, good to be here, and it was yesterday for me a very proud day to have our voter protection operation function so well and facilitate the exercise of a franchise so effectively. So thank you very much, and thanks for giving us a chance.
Thanks so much. Our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Beat up cars and the tires and numbers go.
RFCK in the USA. RFCK in the USA. Yeah, yeah.
in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at ganleylaw.com.
I know that this story might make you tear up, so now would be a good time to reach for a tissue. It's about Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of the Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs. Ready? He only took home $12 million in pay last year. To grasp the terrible sadness of this, you should know that Lord Lloyd hauled in more than $68 million in 2007, the year prior to Wall Street's crash. So, see, you'd be down too if your pay had been cut by 80%. But don't feel too badly for Blankfein and his brothers of the street, for look, a rainbow is beaming across their dark financial sky. And we know what's at the end of that radiant arc, right? Yes, a pot of gold. And the happy news is that the annual pay of Wall Street bankers this year is back up to near record levels. The base salary of all the minions of high finance now averages nearly $400,000, up 16% over the last 2 years. Hey, who says these are hard times? Of course, up in the suites where bankers-in-chief like Blankfein reign, the base pay is much sweeter than average. Plus, base pay is the least of it, for at year's end, it's bonus time. This is when multiple millions of dollars are stuffed into the pockets of the street's elites. And this year is expected to produce a bonus palooza. At last, then, it looks as though Blankfein will overcome the sadness and embarrassment of last year's $12 million check. And who could be more deserving of such a felicitous ending? After all, he labored diligently this year to eliminate 3,200 of Goldman's lower-level employees as a way to save money in order to pay top dollar to Goldman's top bankers, such as himself. This is Jim Hightower saying, so now Blankfein will cash in. Now, that's really something to cry about.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is... Everything's raisin, but the weight is... Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is... Everything's raisin, but the weight is...
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call here at the studio. Today, Financial Times had an interesting quote from John Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House. He said, quote, "With this vote, the American people have also made clear that there is no mandate for raising tax rates." He said, "If there is a mandate, it is a mandate for both parties to find common ground." Yet, if you listen to him, immediately put the line in the sand. We're not going to raise taxes. We'll raise revenue some other way, maybe fees on those poor people, or, you know, maybe fees for your electronic debit card so you can you get food stamps because you poor people need it. You know, you people. Yet I look around the country, where if you look at the exit polling that went on, more than 60% of the people say, you know what? Taxes need to go up. We need to bring more revenue in. You had right around a third of the people said that, wow, you know, taxes shouldn't be raised at all. So we're pandering to that third. And I'm one of the one in seven who said, you know what? Taxes need to go up on just about everybody. I could pay a little bit. If things are as dire as we're told, the fiscal cliff is coming and the debt is going to crush us. And if that's the case, we take care of it now. Don't wait 5 years. Don't wait 10 years. My kids can't. If you truly believe about the children, if you truly care, if it's that big, I don't think it is. I think it's something that's more manageable. But, you know, we need to have these crises. You need to have these hostage situations. This is how the right raises money. But you look around the country. You look at Florida, for instance, where they rejected Amendment 3 down there that would have limited the amount of public spending and revenue collection, would have come up with some bizarre formula on how they're going to raise revenue and spend money. Went down. Only 42% of the people voted for. In Michigan, where they wanted to do that insane thing that California does, where you need a super majority to raise taxes. 69% of the people said no. And you look at California. They approved, what was it, a $6 billion Prop 30, $6 billion in new taxes to pay for schools and roads, pay for education. And you look at Oregon, where they rejected the estate tax cut. I'm sorry, I'm not getting Boehner's position. What I think the American people want is to have that conversation of, you know, how do we keep the country solvent? How do we keep the country going in the right direction? And what investments do we make? That's what we need to be talking about, like adults. I hope this next couple of months, I hope we don't see the petulant GOP. I really don't. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we're gonna talk with Dr. Steven Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, about the fiscal cliff. Right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We got this question. What makes a rooster decide to crow? The answer from scientists is that it has something to do with an alarm clock.
A rooster crows because he has an internal clock that helps him anticipate sunrise. Like all birds, roosters sing or crow in a daily cycle. Almost all animals have daily cycles of activity, circadian rhythms, that roughly follow the cycle of day and night. Roosters anticipate sunrise to get a head start on their daily hunt for food and defensive territory.
But if one rooster in the neighborhood has an internal clock that's set a little early, he can stimulate other roosters to crow early, too. The rooster's sunrise song is actually a way of establishing his territory. When a rooster crows, he's sending out a signal to other roosters that if they trespass, they're asking for a fight.
A rooster will often crow from a vantage point above his territory, so he can make others more aware of his presence, and so his songs travel farther. Even though roosters are the most famous crooners of the chicken world, hens aren't exactly silent either. When a hen spots a hawk, she'll let out a harsh squawk to send her chicks into hiding. But if she sees a less threatening human, she might just cackle. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Democrats in the Senate are terrified that in 2014, the next election, 20 Democrats are up for election, 10 of whom are in very Republican states. If they try and raise taxes, if they shut the government down because they're having a hissy fit that they insist on their little tax increase and that they'd rather shut the government down than not get their tax increase, the Democrats will get wiped out in the Senate in 2014.
Don't blame it on sunshine. Don't blame it on moonlight. Don't blame it on good times.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You got to love Grover Norquist, one of the most powerful men in Pennsylvania. Don't know that he spent much time here in Pennsylvania, but he's evidently controlling our governor. You got to love that mentality, though. They've created this the fiscal cliff is falling, and this hostage situation, this catastrophe, so that they can keep doing what they've been doing. Which is why I've asked our good friend, Dr. Steven Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, keystonesearch.org, their website, to come talk to us about the fiscal cliff is falling. Steve, it's falling. It's going to land on me.
Is that Chicken Little?
It's Chicken something.
Chicken Grover?
It's Chicken something, man.
I think Grover's prediction in that little lead-in tape will be about as accurate as Newt Gingrich's predictions about the election.
Or Dick Morris's.
Yeah, okay. There's a long line of them. They're lining up.
But I've heard this the fiscal cliff, and there's such great imagery. You got to give Republicans credit. The Tax-mageddon, the fiscal cliff, really some great imagery. I hear it's a catastrophe. It's devastating. It's a slow-motion train wreck. Just great imagery. Is it as bad as they're telling us?
I think if you use the rule of thumb that the greater the hyperbole, the smaller the real problem, you're probably going to be right most of the time. No, it's an invented crisis. We got to give people a little background on this, right? This is, August of 2011 was the last time the Republicans in Washington tried to hold the government hostage.
Yep.
Because, again, in the middle of this most difficult economy or recovery since the Great Depression, we don't have enough revenue, so we are running deficits because that's what's keeping people employed, that's what's keeping the economy growing. And they forced a confrontation around what they claimed was the problem of deficits, and they couldn't negotiate a deal then, and so they put in place, they did negotiate what they're now calling the fiscal cliff, right? So they said that if we can't get a deal on deficits by January 1st of 2013, then the Bush tax cuts of 2001 all go away. And also you put in place some automatic cuts, including some pretty substantial cuts in military spending. And so what they're going to, again, now what they're going to do, what Grover was doing there, is they're going to scare people by saying, unless we deal with this fiscal cliff, unless we do exactly the wrong thing for the economy by cutting spending a lot in the short run, particularly for the most vulnerable people, then we're going to have these tax increases. And actually their bargaining situation is not all that good. And so it's really important for people to understand that this is an invented crisis. One of the great things that happens January 1st, as long as they don't force a bad deal, Obama should basically ignore them until January 1st.
Yep.
And, then those tax cuts, including the tax cuts for the folks earning over $250,000, for the millionaires, those tax cuts go away. That's a good thing.
Yeah, let me ask you. If the Bush tax cuts were allowed to expire, why would that be a bad thing? If I remember the Clinton years were pretty damn good.
No, it would be a very good thing. In terms of the short-run economy, the tax cuts on the people making lots of money going away doesn't matter much because they have so much money that that's not going to impact how much they spend. The reason that people aren't investing is not because of high taxes, it's because they don't have customers. So there is an issue of if the tax cuts for middle-class people go away and you didn't do anything else, then that by itself would tend to slow down the economy. So, there is a negotiation to have about whether we want to preserve some of the tax cuts for the middle class, which has been President Obama's position. Again, he's just in a much stronger position if he lets the tax cuts go away then after January, when let's say the Republicans negotiate a deal where we put back the tax cuts for people below 100,000, people below 150,000, whatever number you pick, then they can call that actually a tax cut, right? Because the automatic change is, because the Bush tax cuts that were done a decade ago were basically planned from the beginning to go away in 10 years. That was an accounting gimmick.
Right.
That was all, that was done to reduce the estimates of the long-term impact of those tax cuts on the deficit and the debt long-term, right? I mean, this is the folks who supposedly care about the debt,
yeah,
putting in place an accounting gimmick, but whatever. That accounting gimmick means that those tax cuts go away. They should go away, particularly on the upper-income people. And then, again, let's have a discussion about what tax cuts we want to restore for middle-class people, what spending we absolutely need, because the real way to reduce the deficit is to put people back to work.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, if Congress had passed more of the American Jobs Act 12 months ago, unemployment wouldn't be 7.9% now. It'd be closer to 7% is the estimate. If you'd put in place, President Obama put forward a set of ideas around combination of tax cuts and spending targeted at the people who need help the most, who are on the front lines of this slow recovery. And if that had happened, we'd now be, again, closer to full employment. Tax revenues from businesses and from workers would be going up. And so from the point of view of the deficit and the long-term debt, as well as typical families, we'd all be better off. But no, that wasn't the choice they made.
Yeah,
so,
and the other part of this is, had we not seen the 700,000 public sector jobs being eviscerated and the assault on public sector workers, we'd be a lot further along in our recovery as well, I think.
Exactly. I mean, that was part of the American Jobs Act that they couldn't get through, would be to restore some of that revenue sharing for states and localities so you wouldn't have to lay off 20,000 teachers in Pennsylvania, for example.
Let me ask you this, Steve, because, you know, as this is going to go forward, we're going to hear the Republicans saying, well, we need to cut spending. Let's say we eliminated every bit of discretionary spending we have. Everything's gone. Everything's off the table. We're spending no money in the discretionary budget. Would we close our deficits?
You know, I'm not totally sure. I don't think we would if we didn't. If you're talking about if we preserve, let's say, the tax cuts, but then, so tried to fix the whole long-term deficit just on the spending side, can we?
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument that I keep hearing.
Yeah.
We don't need to raise revenue. We just cut.
We can
cut, and that will solve our problems because there's so much waste, fraud, and abuse.
Yeah, no. And spending, again, as you and I both know, spending's not the problem. The problem right now is our economy's too weak, and what we need to do is fix the economy. Tax cuts for the rich make the deficit worse, but don't help the economy. Tax cuts for the middle class plus spending, you know, extended unemployment insurance, training for people so they can get skills that allow them to get a job, community college education for people, which helps strengthen the economy in the long run, infrastructure spending, right? So the real issue is smart spending and tax cuts for the middle class. That fixes the economy, as well as getting us to a situation where we can work on the deficit more quickly.
And getting our healthcare spending under control as well.
Well, and that was one of Dean Baker's other key points, the economist from Washington, who gave this talk at Dickens that I went to today. Yeah, the long-term deficit issue is really a healthcare spending issue. And there's been some progress in the last few years, actually. The growth of spending on healthcare has slowed considerably in the last several years. It's not exactly clear why, but that's good news. Hopefully, the implementation of the healthcare reform nationally, which now will happen because President Obama was reelected, if that succeeds in continuing to bend the cost curve, you know, as you know, we spend twice as much, roughly speaking, on healthcare as a share of GDP as countries like Canada and the United Kingdom. if we can get our health care costs under control, then the long-term deficit issue goes away as well. But again, for the short run, the really important thing to educate your listeners about is when Republicans in Washington are claiming that we've got this fiscal cliff, claiming that we've got this crisis, therefore we absolutely have to extend tax cuts to really rich people. It's total hogwash. Let's take the time it takes to fix this problem, and people need to look very, very closely at the specific proposals. If people are coming forward with proposals that cut taxes for the rich and don't put in place critical spending for people who need help, or critical spending that strengthens our economy in the long run, then those are folks that aren't really trying to help the broad middle class in America, and that aren't going to fix our economy. So people need to pay close attention, and then they can figure out who's really on their side.
You know, I got about 2 minutes left. And, you know, you, an interesting thing you just said there, you know, because, you know, this idea that we need to continue to cut taxes on the very wealthy, this idea that, you know, we need to, that's how we create jobs, I think completely discredited. And you look across the country where there have been instances where people are raising taxes on themselves because they understand we need to be able to invest. And I think that conversation has to be had, that we're going to raise revenue. This is what we're going to use it for education, infrastructure.
That's right. I mean, there's whether it's Bill Gates' father or Warren Buffett, you know, there are a number of high-profile billionaires who exactly recognize that we all benefit from fair taxes on the rich. Those are the folks that are still benefiting from economic growth. Most people aren't. So we need to get enough revenue from those folks for the system to be fair, and also to help with the investments in infrastructure, education, renewable energy, the things that are going to make our economy strong in the long run. Anyway, the good news is that we're going to have this conversation about the fake crisis of the fiscal cliff in a different political situation than the debate about raising the debt ceiling 15 months ago. And I think the American electorate really turned out in the election yesterday. I think they're paying attention. I think they're in a better position to sort of figure out who's on their side and who's not. So this is a real opportunity to have a clear and honest debate. And and President Obama needs to bargain hard and come up with a deal that does some combination to really address our problems in the short run and the longer run, right, and also to the extent that people are coming forward with proposals that really benefit rich people and don't help the economy in the short run or the long run. He's got to be open. He's got to explain that to people. He's got to help people understand who's on their side and who's not.
I'm with you. Steve Herzenberg, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Take care.
All right. Our good friend, Dr. Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, keystoneresearch.org, the website. Quick break. Back with the second hour of the program. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO today will release national election night polling and detail the labor movement's massive voter mobilization efforts. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka and Political Committee Chair AFSCME President Lee Saunders will also outline how working people plan to hold elected officials accountable to continue rebuilding a middle-class economy. Key findings from voters will be highlighted in the first post-election poll by Hart Research Associates. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says labor political activists knocked on 5.5 million doors and made 5.2 million phone calls during labor's final four-day push to get out the vote. Trumka said that effort was important for President Obama, especially in Ohio and Wisconsin. This election year, labor welcomed activists from organizations like MoveOn.org and Planned Parenthood to multiply its outreach capacity beyond union households. A new six-year labor contract for 1,500 flight attendants at Pinnacle Airlines was ratified by the workers on Tuesday. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the agreement preserves wages, protects affordable health care, and provides job security. The agreement also includes $6.4 million in concessions demanded by management in the bankruptcy restructuring process at the airline. The union doesn't like the agreement, ratified it with help from the National Mediation Board in an effort to minimize the impact on flight attendants. Meanwhile, a union representation election has been scheduled for 9,700 passenger service agents at American Airlines. Voting instructions are being mailed in December, and the results will be counted January 15th. Wisconsin continues to feel the repercussions of returning $810 million in stimulus money for high-speed rail. Jesse Russell reports.
Train manufacturer Talgo had opened a plant in the state thanks to the rail funding. But when Governor Scott Walker took office, he returned the funding to the government, citing costs of upkeep as the reason for rejecting the money. That decision left Talgo in an awkward position due to an additional contract it had with the state to also build passenger trains for Amtrak's Hiawatha line. It was the necessity to build these remaining contracted trains that prevented the company from packing up and leaving the state completely after the high-speed rail money was lost. The company kept 125 workers in place to complete that contract. Talgo now alleges that the state has refused to put the trains in operation and is also refusing to pay millions of dollars it still owes for them. The case has gone to court, and if the state loses, it'll also lose out on $50 million spent on the project. The state responded to Talgo's allegations by saying that the trains don't meet basic federal standards and that Talgo had failed to do proper testing. In a strongly worded statement, Talgo CEO Antonio Perez said, "I don't see how any company would in the future choose to do business with the state of Wisconsin when the state has shown it cannot be trusted to honor contracts that it signed."
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It is not worth fighting for this man if this is the kind of spokesman he has to respond to an ad like this by citing health care
in
Massachusetts.
Listen, but what we're watching and witnessing here.
No, I'm serious about this.
No, I'm serious. I know you're serious.
There's no
I agree
point
with
in
you.
Your show.
I agree with
There's
you.
There's no point in us going to a convention and pushing for this man if he's employing morons like this.
Don't wreck me, bro.
That clip just never gets old for me. I mean, there's no point in you doing your show if he's going to do dumb things. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that Sean Hannity was the titular head of the Republican Party and of the Romney camp, in which, you know, hey, maybe he is. You know, maybe now there's no point in him doing that anymore. But I look at this, and you got to love these hostage, these crises that are always set up. You know, the fiscal cliff. Oh, the fiscal cliff is falling. Oh, we're going to go up to the edge. It's a catastrophe. It's devastating. My favorite one is the slow motion train wreck. It's one of my favorite pieces of imagery. And, you know, the reality is this was because they could not do their job to begin with. So as, you know, Bob Casey said the other day, well, we made it so bad that we would have to do something. And, you know, you look, they're talking about $7 trillion worth of either tax increases or spending cuts over the next decade. And, of course, you know, we're going to be looking at the debt ceiling crisis as well. But, you know, they're talking about defense and non-defense spending cuts, doing away with the Bush tax cuts, which I'm in favor of. Just get rid of them, and let's start talking about having a tax code that's going to encourage people to, well, to spend a little money at the bottom. Because that's where we know demand is. You know, the whole, there's a lot of things we should be doing differently. And, you know, this setup, because we're being set up in this. Understand that. The Republicans are setting us up because, you know, the Grover Norquists of the world, oh, we can't raise taxes on the wealthy. Because they've continued to hammer it in our heads. And again, I've yet to find a rational person who's going to be able to make a cogent argument that by giving the billionaire class as much as by creating this enormous billionaire class, how it's helped the working people. Because they don't create jobs. And I've said this before, no one's ever given me a job. Said, Rick, I like you so much, here's a job. You don't have to do anything, you don't have to produce anything. Here's a job. I just like you. I got this tax cut from the government, and you know, I felt good, and I felt giving and caring, and you seem like a decent human being. I've never seen that. What I have seen is I've seen people go, well, you know what, I need to get something done because somebody wants something and I can make money off of them and it's going to cost me less to pay you than I'm going to charge them so I can make a profit off of it. That's how I see it going. So when I look at these, and I think Herzenberg was right, you know, when you look at these, the bigger the play up, the bigger the scenario, the bigger the BS, the more you got to look behind the curtain, don't you think? But you know, here we're gonna be talking about a bunch of issues over the next couple of months, and you know, a lot of them, you know, around taxes, a lot of them around debt, because the debt limit is gonna be back. Which for me, I just think is, at some point you just go, we're gonna do away with this because it's nothing but one of these ticking bomb things that we're gonna, every couple of months, every couple of years or whatever it's gonna be, we're gonna ruin our credit rating. And we need to start talking about, you know, what kind of cuts are they talking about? More austerity? We've seen what austerity has done. Austerity has stopped our country from recovering as quickly as it should have. And you look across over in Europe, where austerity is basically plummeting them into another recession. You look in Greece right now, where they're rioting in the streets because, you know what? They're screwing their workers. And you come back here and you go, okay, spending cuts, because we're going to hear a lot about spending cuts. The people at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, they came out with a graph, I think it was yesterday, that said, you know, right now, domestic spending is already projected to hit an all-time low. Think about this. We're already spending less than we have ever spent. We're at a record low of our GDP. A record low. And yet they want to take it lower. And the reason I asked Dr. Herzenberg about, let's say we just eliminated all the discretionary spending, all of it, because it's like 17% of our budget. If we just have eliminated all of it, would it solve our problems? And the answer is no. It would cause a lot of pain. It would cause a lot of misery. And it wouldn't solve our problems. So there's a lot of work that has not been done over the last 2 years because, you know, what kind of frustrates me about yesterday is in a lot of congressional districts, and a lot of this has to do with gerrymandering, we've seen the status quo. So what's going to happen the next couple of months? What's going to happen the next 2 years? Are we going to see the same gridlock where nothing gets done? I mean, there are a lot of things that need to be done. I think about the Postal Service. You know, we're allowing the Postal Service twice now to have defaulted on their pension payments and their health care payments. All in the push to privatize. You think about the unemployment insurance extensions that are going to expire unless something happens. And, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. The farm bill that we don't have. The infrastructure bill we don't have. I mean, so many things that, well, we haven't done. And we really need to be working on. But here again, it's this gridlock. It's this delay. Which is why, you know, like Obama said, you know, we need to be staying involved. It's not about just voting. Being a citizen of this country, being part of this democracy doesn't end at the ballot box. It means staying active, staying engaged. And the more we hear about the tax plans, and look, there's some stuff the Democrats are talking about, not thrilled about this grand bargain, which we're going to be talking about for the next couple of months. And this whole push towards another tax reform bill, like the one they did in 86, who virtually everybody agrees didn't work, had little, if any, impact on growth. And those are the Republicans saying it had nothing. Bruce Bartlett, former Reagan administration economist, said that didn't really do anything. Gross domestic product was the same in 86 as it was in 87. But what it did do, and understand, because we're going to be told this again, what it did do is it lowered that top marginal tax rate. Lowered it substantially, which eventually cost George H.W. Bush re-election. Understand that, for Republicans, understand that's what happened. Because Reagan had lowered it so far, and the promises were made were so grandiose that, oh, we're going to cut these loopholes, and all of this money is going to come streaming in, and those billionaires, they're going to take that money, and they're going to put it into the economy, because, like Mitt Romney said during the campaign, it's the private sector that creates jobs. And I go, well, not necessarily. It's demand that creates jobs. I mean, that's the reality. It's when people like you and me and government spend money. That creates jobs. Like it or not. And look, there's the part of me that's the conservationist that goes, you know, what gets us out of this crisis is more consumption. And do we really need more consumption? We need to be producing more things at home. We need to be pushing for domestic production laws. I can guarantee you that's not going to happen. I mean, for me, and I've been saying this for the past couple of weeks since Romney brought Jeep up, for me, the number one thing we should be looking at, because it solves a lot of our problems, domestic production, building stuff, employing people. That's what's going to help our country. Because like Dr. Herzenberg said, once you start getting people back to work, they start paying taxes. They start consuming and creating other jobs. And it's a spiraling thing. You know, the economies very rarely stay stagnant. They either spiral up or they spiral down. And it's what you do to encourage that spiral to go either way. So when during the Bush years we encourage the wealth class to steal and do all kinds of really risky things, well, what ended up happening? Well, not just a spiraling down, but a free fall down. And when you see the stimulus come out and putting money into the economy, you start to see a spiraling up. Things start to get better. More people start to work. Had we not said, oh, well, half of that money from the stimulus is going to go to tax handouts. Had we said, you know what, we're going to build those roads and bridges and we're going to consume things. Because if you listen to Romney, and remember, if you listen to what he was saying, he was talking huge stimulus. He just wasn't using the word stimulus. It just blows the mind. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I know that this story might make you tear up, so now would be a good time to reach for a tissue. It's about Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of the Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs. Ready? He only took home $12 million in pay last year. To grasp the terrible sadness of this, you should know that Lord Lloyd hauled in more than $68 million in 2007, the year prior to Wall Street's crash. So, see, you'd be down too if your pay had been cut by 80%. But don't feel too badly for Blankfein and his brothers of the street, for look, a rainbow is beaming across their dark financial sky. And we know what's at the end of that radiant arc, right? Yes, a pot of gold. And the happy news is that the annual pay of Wall Street bankers this year is back up to near record levels. The base salary of all the minions of high finance now averages nearly $400,000, up 16% over the last 2 years. Hey, who says these are hard times? Of course, up in the suites where bankers-in-chief like Blackfine reign, the base pay is much sweeter than average. Plus, base pay is the least of it, for at year's end, it's bonus time. This is when multiple millions of dollars are stuffed into the pockets of the street's elites, and this year is expected to produce a bonus palooza. At last, then, it looks as though Blankfein will overcome the sadness and embarrassment of last year's $12 million check. And who could be more deserving of such a felicitous ending? After all, he labored diligently this year to eliminate 3,200 of Goldman's lower-level employees as a way to save money in order to pay top dollar to Goldman's top bankers, such as himself. This is Jim Hightower saying, so now Blankfein will cash in. Now, that's really something to cry about.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
I'll tell you. There's part of me that would have liked to have Eddie Munster as VP. Just a small sadistic part of me. Just very, very small. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So Ari Fleischer, the Bush former press secretary, said that the Republicans are never going to embrace the LGBT community or women's rights. That they should instead, you know, they should wrestle with the Hispanic issue. We're not going to go with the gays or those women, but you know the immigrants. Well, maybe we better figure out how to do something with. If they want to be a relevant party, they're going to have to. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Ike on line one. How are you doing tonight, Ike? Ike, how are you? Did I lose you?
Sorry. You there?
Yep.
You there?
What's up?
Yeah, buddy. It's a great day to be American. How you doing?
I am good. I would like to have been a little bit better. There's some House seats I would have liked seen picked up. There's some seats here in Pennsylvania I would like to pick up. But overall, I'm feeling better than I would have had Romney won.
Yeah, right. And by the way, what the hell's wrong with Minnesota? Michelle Bachmann didn't get knocked off? Come on now. I have a favorite phrase for her, bat crap crazy, Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah.
But listen, here's the deal. This is the way I see it. And, you know, it's hard to be humble when you're right all the time, which I am on most cases. But look, here's the deal. Republicans, here's your message. This is what you need to learn, okay?
You're going to give out the secret, are you? You're going to give out the secret? You're going to help them out?
Yeah, and I'm going to, I'm not going to show them the secret handshake.
Okay.
But I'm going to let them know the secret, okay? Here's the secret, okay? Quit protecting the oligarchs. Come to the table. Sit down. Listen, we all understand, yes, we need to tighten up entitlements. We need to tighten up fraud, waste, and abuse, which, by the way, the Obama administration has been doing a great job. If you haven't noticed, they've been rounding up these pill mill doctors and these guys writing all this fake garbage to the tune of, $4 or $5 billion over the last year. He's been throwing people in prison for it. Okay, there's plenty of room to fix this, okay? But as long as you continue to want to protect oligarchs and the 1%, and you want to act like it's your right to have all these millions and billions of dollars and no responsibility to your country, you've got a problem. Oh, and by the way, this isn't a Democratic problem. This is a Republican problem. The Republican problem is this.
Boehner.
He's got a problem with the Tea Party. They've got a split in the Republican Party, and you've got a Speaker of the House that can't control his own party. That's where the real problem has been. Look, cooler heads are going to prevail here, and we're going to get something done. Now, you can either get on the train and go, or, I don't know, Rick, what do you think? If they want to keep playing the same game they've been playing, do you think not only are the ones that were supposed to be suppressed from voting stood in line and said, hell no, you're not, and proved the point to them, but you know what? The midterms will be a bloodbath if they don't change it. don't you think?
Well, that's the hope. I mean, what my concern is, you know, I go back to, I'm not a big fan of Dick Cheney, but I do think he is right when he says the Democrats cave. It's what they do. My fear is that there are so many more centrist Democrats than there are centrist Republicans. And
right.
My fear is that some of the Social Security stuff goes the wrong way. We see the Medicare a little bit going the wrong way, and the tax cuts for a portion of the wealthy. I don't see the million and up getting away unscathed, but I see the higher end in there staying unscathed, which, again, if things are as bad as they're telling us, if the situation is as bad as it is, we need all hands on deck.
Well, you know what? I'm kind of a bit of an opposite mind. I think that now, Mr. Obama has carte blanche to unleash the angry black man. And to be quite honest with you, if I was in his shoes, number one, I would flood the disaster area with as much stuff as I could give him. Okay. Number two, I would sign every executive order I had at my fingertips. Number three, I'd be hitting them with bills left and right in the Congress. As a matter of fact, the way that I look at it, I probably would have called him in the session the day after the election. Oh, and by the way, I know I'm nobody, but I'll just tell you straight up. If I had a piece of advice for him that would really help him, listen, don't go off on this inauguration crap, okay? Do a little party, but don't make it extravagant. Let's just get on with the business of the country. And, oh, by the way, also, too, if you find yourself getting, you know, mired down in the politics, do like Reagan did. That's what his most powerful weapon was. When he had a problem, he got on the air and he told the American people, and the American people jumped in behind him. So, listen, it's not just about the election, my friend. Oh, and by the way, one other thing, too. I'm sorry. I'm trying to get all this in.
Yeah.
Just so you know, I'm calling you from North Charleston here, and I'm in the 6th District, and we did put Clyburn back in office, and we did go for Obama. And I know a lot of people that are not in my area, and folks up north and other places, you know, just so you know, we're not all stupid rednecks. We don't buy all this Fox News crap. We don't all roll that way. And I got to tell you, man, around my part of the world, right here where I'm living, oh, my God, people were walking. You could tell who the Republicans were, and you could tell who the Democrats were, because the Democrats, their feet weren't even touching the ground today. But it was miserable weather today. It was overcast. It was cold. It was raining and all that. And, boy, let me tell you something. We were just happier than, oh, my God. And I couldn't resist. I had to rub their nose in it. And that's the other point.
Be nice.
Look, you want compromise, that's fine. But, by God, listen, we know what they've done, and we know what they continue to do, and we know who pushed our credit rating down. We know all this, and the message is clear. And if Binder doesn't get it, he's going to get it, because I'm telling you, we're done with this. You either get to the table and negotiate or get the hell out, because I guarantee you the midterms, we're coming for you.
I hope you're right, Ike. It's always great talking to you, brother.
Yes, sir. Thanks, buddy.
And, you know, I'm hoping, you know, and this is why I keep saying we need to keep active, engaged, and we need to keep involved in the process. You know, the reality is you look, right now the way it looks, so the Democrats are going to have, what, 54, potentially 55 Senate seats? Well, 53, and then two independents who, it appears, are going to caucus with the Democrats. But in the House, you got, 233 to 192. 10 seats are still up in the air. So the Republicans are going to hold that. But, you know, here's the thing. In the House, where the passions run wild and they're up for election every 2 years, Ike is right. There's a potential. There is a potential to do what they did in 2008. And I had hoped, you know, there's a very small part of me that hoped that there would be some type of a House revolt, where we would expel all of the Tea Party, and a lot of them lost. I mean, my favorite guy, Joe Walsh, the deadbeat, he's out. It looks like Alan West is out, and another Tea Party gone. And that's what we need. We need to get rid of that element, that useful idiot for the wealth class, because that's what they were. Early on, and you know, and I've said this before, early on, I could have been one of the Tea Party people, went to a couple of the early rallies and some of the early meetings where, you know, they were still talking about the issues that were important. Hey, how do we get an economy that works for everybody? How do we make sure that, you know, the American dream that we were raised to believe was possible is possible? And you got people who are like me, who are ticked off. You know, the world that we envisioned hasn't quite turned out that way because we've got a political system that benefits the handful. But almost immediately, that entire movement was taken over and funded heavily by the very people that it should have been going after. And very early, the message changed. Because where it lost me is, well, government's the problem and corporations are the solution. And this whole business-friendly, benevolent corporation thing. Look, I'm not anti-business, but they're not the savior. They're a tool of the economy. You know, I had an interesting conversation with a friend today. We were talking about, as the economy, as the demographics continue to grow, what we've seen is we've seen mechanization, we've seen high productivity, we've seen all of this outsourcing, and a lot of questions come up because of this. And they're very real political questions, and if you can neuter the political process, if you can delegitimize it, which I do see the right doing as we are speaking, trying to delegitimize what happened yesterday. And, oh, it's not about the bad ideas. It's not about the policies. Oh, no, Mitt lost because, well, Mitt was just ran a bad campaign. And he didn't run as good a campaign as Obama did. He didn't. But Obama had to run almost a picture-perfect campaign because all of the talking points were against him. Some people that I know bought into, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And I kept saying, well, yeah, of course we are. We're not in free fall. But at the end of this, and, you know, the way I see us going forward is that part of his speech last night where he said, look, you know, we want the same things. And that's what we need to focus on. We want safe neighborhoods. We want good schools. We want good infrastructure. We want to have a military second to none. We want to have all of these things that we view as what makes this country great. And the question is how do you get them? They don't just appear. They have to come through smart investment, smart policy, and it has to be pursued. But that can't happen when you have a small, very small, minute segment of the population who has tons of resources at their disposal to be able to incite, to be able to divide, and to misinform. I mean, if this election taught us anything, it taught us that, wow, what a ton of money can do. I mean, I look at Tom Smith, the guy who ran against Casey, was down 20 points over the summer. Had no business being in the race, completely politically, just not somebody who could even stand and complete a sentence in front of people. Somehow he closed the gap. Why? $17 million. I look at all this money that was spent, and, you know, as a nation, we should be talking about how's the best way to spend the resources of the nation? That's the question. And the more I think about it, the more we need to stay active. We need to stay involved, engaged, and push. Push, push, push. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Earth, sky.
We got this question. What makes a rooster decide to crow? The answer from scientists is that it has something to do with an alarm clock.
A rooster crows because he has an internal clock that helps him anticipate sunrise. Like all birds, roosters sing or crow in a daily cycle. Almost all animals have daily cycles of activity, circadian rhythms, that roughly follow the cycle of day and night. Roosters anticipate sunrise to get a head start on their daily hunt for food and defensive territory.
But if one rooster in the neighborhood has an internal clock that's set a little early, he can stimulate other roosters to crow early, too. The rooster's sunrise song is actually a way of establishing his territory. When a rooster crows, he's sending out a signal to other roosters that if they trespass, they're asking for a fight.
A rooster will often crow from a vantage point above his territory, so he can make others more aware of his presence, and so his songs travel farther. Even though roosters are the most famous crooners of the chicken world, hens aren't exactly silent either. When a hen spots a hawk, she'll let out a harsh squawk to send her chicks into hiding. But if she sees a less threatening human, she might just cackle. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Money green, the change all around. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So Joe Walsh went down, my favorite deadbeat. Alan West looks like he's going to go down, Tea Party favorite. I expect to see him getting a nice Tea Party gig somewhere, maybe a fake news on Fox gig. Sadly, though, 1L Michelle, well, she seems to have eked out. And you gotta wonder what's wrong with that district. But yesterday, you know, big victories around the country, which is why I've asked Neil Sorka, press secretary with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, their website, boldprogressives.org. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Come talk to us about the big win for progressives across the country. Neil, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, hey, great to be here, Rick.
You know, I look at Elizabeth Warren, and there's part of me, the first thing I thought this morning is, boy, I'll bet you the Republicans in the Senate wish they would have confirmed her as the head of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau about now.
I mean, don't you think that? Yeah, listen, the PCCC, we played and we're just so happy yesterday. I mean, that win was not only was a big win for the country, big win for progressives, but it was a big win for us because we actually launched the draft Warren effort. We were big backers of her, you know, when she was in the fight for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and we launched the draft effort for her in July of 2011. We raised about $100,000 before she even got in the race, and over the course of the campaign, our members contributed over $1 million to her race, and most importantly, we ran this awesome Call Out the Vote program, which is why I'm still down here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where our program was based, but it was a national distributed calling program. And we made nearly 600,000 calls for Elizabeth Warren. So it was a huge, huge priority for us. Our members were super excited about her. And, you know, she didn't just win yesterday. She trounced Scott Brown.
Yeah.
And, you know, that says a lot about the kind of working people and the energy and enthusiasm that there was for her up in Massachusetts.
I remember one of the correspondents that we get from a couple of news services before the election, before she was – before she, it was during the primaries, if I remember right.
Yeah.
They said, he told me, well, she's just way too liberal to be elected in Massachusetts. And I'm going, I don't, what are you thinking today there, buddy?
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, she fits Massachusetts like the glove. And most of all, like, compared to night, you know, there are a number of progressive voices in the Senate who won yesterday. You know, Elizabeth Warren being the one that's foremost, I think, in so many of our minds. But Sherrod Brown winning his reelection. Yeah, talk about another great, you know, fighter for working people.
Well, but here's the thing. I mean, you know, the reality is he ran against the guy who, well, this is my favorite clip. I think this will be my favorite clip for as long as I live.
They think coal is a four-letter word.
You know, when you're running against a guy who says something like, hey, that coal's a four-letter word, I guess he never played Scrabble, it can't be all that difficult.
No, you wouldn't think, but listen, I mean, when they were throwing, and this is the reality of it, and actually the kind of undertold story of today, that how much did Karl Rove spend on elections over the last year, and all of it flushed down the toilet, an absolute miserable failure. On his part. And this, that was one of the races. Sherrod Brown's race, one of the places where the Koch brothers and Karl Rove spent the heaviest and frankly lost big time.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of this, and what I've been saying is you look at all of this money that's been spent. I saw something, and maybe you've got a better number, somewhere around $6.5 billion in this election cycle. Yeah. And I gotta be honest, there are a lot more things that I think we should be doing with $6.5 billion, than hate ads and the attacks that I saw all over my TV screen.
No, you're right. And you know what was the big lesson, I think, for progressives and a lot of folks across the country was, despite that $6.5 billion that was spent on this race, ultimately what won the day in so many of these House and Senate races, these progressive races, were boots on the ground and, you know, receivers up to the ears. The winning people won this by making the calls, talking to voters, and overcoming the ads, because the reality is, for the most part, and listen, we do ads ourselves, we focus on really compelling ads featuring, you know, folks that we actually meet in these communities and kind of elevating the voices of real people. But the reality is a much stronger thing, you know, is that phone call, is the conversation that the individual volunteer has with the voter than any ad you're going to put on television or radio.
You mean you use real people? You don't use RNC staffers and,
I know,
and campaign people and set up your fake press conferences? Come on.
No, I mean, that's the best part about our organization. At BillProgressives.org, our members sign up, and we have about over a million members nationwide. And when we have a question, like we wanted to find someone in Carol Shea Porter's district in New Hampshire who had an experience with healthcare, and we put together this phenomenal ad of these folks telling the story of how, despite even having insurance themselves, you know, it wouldn't cover the gentleman's heart attack. And so if private insurance couldn't help them, how could we think that, you know, spending money on privatizing Medicare would help seniors and working families, you know, going forward? So, listen, people in this country, and what we learn from our members is, you know, the actual voters, the actual boots on the ground have the best stories out there. And if we just find a way to tell them, that's what's really going to compel voters to actually make the right choices in some of these elections.
Yeah, I was listening to the president's victory speech last night, and he brought up the 8-year-old girl from Mentor, Ohio, who, you know, the father had health care. The insurance company just at one point wanted to stop paying. And thanks to the health care laws, no, you can't do that. And those are the kind of stories that need to get out. And the thing that I like about your group is you're out there actually talking to people. And the more we talk about values, the more we talk about progressive ideals, the more I think you realize that more of this country is progressive than conservative. It's just that conservative people who call themselves conservatives have been inundated with this, bombarded with this pro-corporate, pro-wealth class message for so long that they've kind of bought into it.
The progressive message is the American message. There is no doubt about it. It is deeply ingrained. The idea that, you know, you're your brother's keeper and that you have to, we work better together than we do separately. That's the fundamental principles of this country. That's what we were built on from, you know, even before our founding. And, the reality is that, you know, once we actually tell folks stories and tell people the reality behind the policies that we're supporting and pushing for, we win. And so it's just a matter of getting the word out and telling people what we stand for.
Yeah, I mean, I look at Joe Walsh, who, you know, it's probably going to be the last day I beat up on him because he's out of Congress right now. But the American Family Association gave him the Family Values Award, one of their highest awards to people in Congress for his fight for working families. Yet the guy owes his ex-wife, $117,000 in back
child support. Yeah.
I mean, is that family values in that world? Did I miss something?
No. These people think they can lie and stretch the truth and that voters won't actually pay attention to them. And Tammy Duckworth, I think, is a great Democrat, an American hero. Is she a progressive? No, she's probably not going to be the greatest, you know, progressive in Congress. But listen, she was able to really tell the truth about what was going on, who Joe Walsh was, and really make him own some of his absurd statements that he's made. And she's going to make a heck of a lot better member of Congress than Joe Walsh ever would.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to see him go, but there's part of me, you know, the part of me that likes, that does this program, that needs people like him for comedy relief.
Yeah, I'd say.
So let me ask you this. You know, yesterday was a big victory. Today, the real hard work begins. What are you guys doing from this point forward? Because, you know, I don't know if you've heard, but there's a fiscal cliff about ready to fall. There's this big crisis coming. There's the hostage situation, 24, the ticking bomb. It's all right there.
This is something that we're going to have to pay. You know, we were thinking about even before today, and it's one of the reasons why a big issue, and every single candidate that we supported at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and you can see them all still at boldprogressives.org, every single candidate that we supported agreed that there is no room for benefit cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So Elizabeth Warren, Annie Custer, Carol Shea Porter, Alan Grayson, all these sort of figures are going to be leaders in the House and Senate when we're fighting for this fiscal cliff nonsense. And they're going to say, when the president and others try to force a deal which ultimately leads to benefit cuts for seniors and working families, they're going to be the voices that are saying no. They're going to be the conscience of this party. And that's how we're going to have to fight. We're going to have to stand up with them when they're, you know, taking the hard road, perhaps against the president himself. And we're going to have to make sure that they know that we're behind them 110% when they stick to what they've agreed to or promised us during this election.
Yeah, you know, I woke up this morning to talk of the grand bargain.
Yeah.
And I got to be honest, you know, I'm concerned about that. I mean, I support the president and all of that, and I support a number of the Democrats. But when you start talking about pushing Social Security off longer and you start talking about cuts to our social safety net program, I got a real concern with that.
Yeah, you know, one of the big issues, I think, for, you know, folks when they talk about this, especially if they're, you know, the ruling class that is, you know, so concerned with the longevity of Social Security and the rising costs of Medicare. And listen, there's no doubt about it. In the case of where Social Security, I disagree that there's a problem. There definitely is a problem in the long term for Medicare, just because costs are rising out of control.
Yeah, and for me, the answer, Neil, is bringing everybody into it and getting healthy people
Medicare
into it instead of making sure that I've said this before. I wish I could find a business where I can only get the most profitable customers, where I don't have to deal with everybody. And, you know, those sick people and the kids and the old folks, yeah, those are somebody else's problem.
Yeah, no, you're entirely right. I mean, at the end of the day, what we need to do is continue to push for, you know, to bring more and more people into Medicare. That's going to be the solution. We need to ensure that everyone has the option to buy into a program that universally is one of the most loved programs out there that the federal government does. Highly effective. But, you know, listen, the costs are spiraling out of control. But the way we do that, the way we fix it, is not by cutting the benefits of seniors and working families. That's just not a positive solution, especially when, as Elizabeth Warren so wonderfully says all the time, the middle class has spent the last 20 years getting hammered. And we need people in there that are fighting for us and are going to ensure that when we're looking to trim costs and get the deficit under control, that the first place you turn is not the places in the programs that seniors and working families need to survive.
Yep. I mean, the first club out of the bag should not be what saved us from another depression in 2008.
Exactly. How many people, when, you know, that were living on Social Security, their pensions dried, their pensions dried up, or their 401ks, were no longer, giving them the dividends and they needed to get by, relied on Social Security. The last thing we need is the privatization of Social Security that so many of these Republicans that were running and lost, were pushing for it. That's the last thing we need. And, Democrats need to stand up and say no. To benefit cuts when, we start having these arguments going forward.
Yeah, like FDR said when Labor came to him and said, we want a bunch of this stuff. He said, well, get out there and get the support to push me in that direction and make me do it, which is why I keep telling people we got to stay active and engaged. We got to keep pushing. Let me ask you this last line of questioning. The election yesterday, do you think it was a referendum on privatization of Social Security and the whole voucher of Medicare? Do you think can you take a referendum out of that?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think it was a referendum on a couple things. Number one, I think it was a referendum on the Ryan budget. Listen, Paul Ryan, despite every attempt by, the Republican ticket, lost Wisconsin horribly. And actually, an interesting factoid that a lot of folks don't know, he also faced a really strong challenger in his district, Rob Durbin, who despite not being able to campaign against him because Paul Ryan was running as vice president, but he ran against him and lost by less than any other person that Paul Ryan had run against prior. He lost by, less than half of what the people that had run against him, before. So there's no doubt that even in Paul Ryan's own district, he was facing issues based on, the plan that he put forward in Congress that would end Medicare. So, there's no doubt about it. That was a failed plan. It's not a solution. And going forward, the big lesson to take home is this was a real referendum on the kind of solutions that Republicans are offering versus the kind of solutions that Democrats are offering. And there's no doubt about it. People want to make sure that the wealthy are paying their fair share, and they don't want to be seeing cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security benefits, things that seniors and families rely on. So that's the message that comes through, and that's the message that Democrats need to remember as we go into this fight on the so-called fiscal cliff. That's what this election was about, and they need to hold Republicans' feet to the fire on that.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And as you pointed out, especially as we were moving into this, the fiscal cliff. I love that. I got to be honest. I love that imagery. Taxmageddon, the fiscal cliff. You got to love that stuff. I mean, you got to give the right credit. They're masters at verbal manipulation.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, this is a thing that we did to itself. The reality is the fiscal cliff is really the expiration of the Bush tax cuts that should have expired years ago.
Yep.
So it's time to move on. It's time to – we're going to have to fight this. And in some cases, over the next few months, we're going to have to stand up to the president. But as someone who worked for the president's campaign starting in May of 2007, I know deep down, whatever he supports now, he wants organizers pushing him and working harder because – we've got to make him do it. He's going to be there, and it's our job to push him in the right direction.
And the reality is thanks to yesterday, we got a better chance of pushing the guy in that Oval Office in the right direction than we would have had if the other guy was there. Neil Sorka, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. BoldProgressive.org, the website. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks a lot, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Drowning in grass and lies. Save the USA and resume the tax and fine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job that you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security. Call BBS at 1-866-866-866. 402-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high-interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pfecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
We need a third party to save this country. Not Ron Paul and the Ron Paulites. No, we need a legitimate third party to challenge the current system that we have. Because I don't believe that the Republican Party, although I ran as a Republican, I have been voting Republican for decades, I don't believe the Republican Party has the ability to rebrand itself.
Oh, well, the Herminator. Boy, I got to tell you, I miss him. I sure missed him during the camp. I love the 999 plan. I loved the Mark Block video. Remember that? Where we realized that evidently smoking is a good thing now. Really very twisted view. But, you know, hey, we're going to be able to get a lot of the Herminator. He's going to be taking over a nationally syndicated radio program here the first of the year. So I'm waiting for the gems to come rolling off of his tongue. Sadly, no more Joe Walsh to kick around. Going to miss the deadbeat there. Also, Alan West gone down. And, you know, you go back and you look at, you know, a lot of the Alan West stuff. You know, progressives are communists. Like the guy we just talked to, Neural Sorka. I wonder what Sorka would think about being called a communist. But, you know, that's the world view. You know, you keep throwing out this really bizarre, language that, you know, somebody's going to pick up on. You know, early voting is an entitlement, evidently, according to Alan. Said that Obama's campaign slogan had a Marxist socialist meaning. You know, I guess, you know, I got to tell you, I would hate to live in a world that twisted. Again, a lot of his ideas, you know, like food stamps, enslave people. You know, feeding your children somehow enslaves you. This was somebody who was sitting in the halls of Congress. This was somebody who had their hands near the levers of power. The idea that Social Security enslaves people. Obama wants to enslave people. He liked a lot of that, and you got to give Alan credit. You know, he knows where where the insanity is. Said Barney Frank should be in a pink jumpsuit, and you got to wonder what did he mean by that. I don't know, but I'm kind of sad to see Alan go. I mean, a lot of fun there. Sad to see Joe Walsh go. A lot of fun there. I'm glad though, Michelle, she's still there, and as everyone knows, I'm a big fan of hers. I love insanity. Our quote of the day comes from Grover Norquist. Wrote a very interesting piece, How Stand the Correlation of Forces in American Politics. I don't know what it means either, but this is where it's from. He basically said the American voters have confirmed the status quo. He said this election showed Republicans in the House that the path to prosperity authored by Paul Ryan was not simply sound on principle, but a political advantage. He said they have an agenda. They voted for it. They won re-election. The Democrats in the Senate and the White House will eventually have to write down something and vote for it. He said then we could have a national debate that was deliberately avoided in this election. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think this, along with a referendum on Social Security, along with the referendum on Medicare, I think the Ryan Romney plan, the budget, that the policies and the priorities that they put forth were soundly pushed back against. This idea that more tax cuts for the wealthy were somehow going to get us out of the situation that more tax cuts for the wealthy created, I think that's kind of off base. But if you look at, you know, you look at Grover, you know, he's got to keep pushing that anti-tax thing. And for me, when I look at the states, and I look at Pennsylvania is a very, very interesting state in that Obama won huge. I mean, it was really early. It was called Casey won big, yet only five of the 18 congressional seats went to Democrats. And you go back and you think about the gerrymandering that went on. Explain to me how it is that Obama carries Pennsylvania by more than 5 points and Casey by a larger margin than that, yet only five of the 18 congressional seats go to Democrats, where Democrats, by huge numbers, outnumbered the number of Republicans. That, my friends, is the mastery of the scalpel and the Republican drawing machine. Which is why I've been saying for the longest time what we need to be doing is we need to get this power out of the hands of the legislatures. There needs to be a uniform way at which we redistrict, a uniform way at which when the census comes up, we make sure that people get equal representation. Because where I live, the races aren't even going to be close to competitive. I look at the Schuster race, not even competitive. You look at the state of Pennsylvania, and you almost can't find on the map where the Democrats are located. The state, and I got a picture of it right in front of me, the state is a sea of red. And how is that possible? Well, creative drawing. And I look at the Cartwright district, which is just mind-blowing. I don't know how you come up with the Cartwright district. Have no idea. And I can't even give you an image of what it could be other than all over the place. And the more I say, you know, this is where the political process, maybe we've given too much power of people in our legislatures to determine their own outcome. And that's what happened across the country. You know, while you can say, yeah, okay, the Republicans held the House 233 to 192 and their 10 seats still, you know, being decided. Democrats did have more votes, yet not more seats. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
I announce the winner on the radio with my microphone. I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO today will release national election night polling and detail the labor movement's massive voter mobilization efforts. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka and Political Committee Chair AFSCME President Lee Saunders will also outline how working people plan to hold elected officials accountable
to continue rebuilding a middle-class economy. Key findings from voters will be highlighted in the first post-election poll by Hart Research Associates. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says labor political activists knocked on 5.5 million doors and made 5.2 million phone calls during labor's final four-day push to get out the vote. Trumka said that effort was important for President Obama, especially in Ohio and Wisconsin. This election year, labor welcomed activists from organizations like MoveOn.org and Planned Parenthood to multiply its outreach capacity beyond union households. A new six-year labor contract for 1,500 flight attendants at Pinnacle Airlines was ratified by the workers on Tuesday. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the agreement preserves wages, protects affordable health care, and provides job security. The agreement also includes $6.4 million in concessions demanded by management in the bankruptcy restructuring process at the airline. The union doesn't like the agreement, but ratified it with help from the National Mediation Board in an effort to minimize the impact on flight attendants. Meanwhile, a union representation election has been scheduled for 9,700 passenger service agents at American Airlines. Voting instructions are being mailed in December, and the results will be counted January 15th. Wisconsin continues to feel the repercussions of returning $810 million in stimulus money for high-speed rail. Jesse Russell reports.
Train manufacturer Talgo had opened a plant in the state thanks to the rail funding. But when Governor Scott Walker took office, he returned the funding to the government, citing costs of upkeep as the reason for rejecting the money. That decision left Talgo in an awkward position due to an additional contract it had with the state to also build passenger trains for Amtrak's Hiawatha line. It was the necessity to build these remaining contracted trains that prevented the company from packing up and leaving the state completely after the high-speed rail money was lost. The company kept 125 workers in place to complete that contract. Talgo now alleges that the state has refused to put the trains in operation and is also refusing to pay millions of dollars it still owes for them. The case has gone to court, and if the state loses, it'll also lose out on $50 million spent on the project. The state responded to Talgo's allegations by saying that the trains don't meet basic federal standards and that Talgo had failed to do proper testing. In a strongly worded statement, Talgo CEO Antonio Perez said, "I don't see how any company would in the future choose to do business with the state of Wisconsin when the state has shown it cannot be trusted to honor contracts that it signed."
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fox News alert, it's election day, and we got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
Yeah, he was standing guard. And you know what else he was doing? He was opening the door. That's intimidation. If I ever saw intimidation, how dare he open the door? Wow. I guess when you need something to talk about, you start off with the premise that the Black Panther Party is going to be out there intimidating people. You find the footage that you can. And it's a clip of about 10 seconds and 5 seconds of it, the guy opening the door. But he did look very intimidating. He looked like he looked a little angry as he was opening the door. Gotta love it. Anyway, welcome back to the third hour of the program. If you missed any portion of the program so far, you can download the podcast there at the website, thericksmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Yesterday, a lot of stories across the state of voter problems. The ID thing kept coming up. Long lines, especially in Philadelphia. Registration problems, tons of things, which is why I've asked Stephen Rosenfeld. He's a writer over at Alternet. His article, Chaos, Disinformation, and Glitches Plague Key States, Our Broken Election System in Action. Stephen, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, nice to be here.
You know, I look at what's going on. The Black Panthers, did you hear that? The Black Panthers were guarding, the intimidating. They were threatening and mean looking.
Yeah, well, this is their favorite new thing. You know, bring out somebody to scare the white folks into voting.
Yeah, but he opened the door.
This is not the first time they've tried to resurrect this, and it's really like a pet project of one of the hardcore right-wing, you know, voter fraud guys, J. Christian Adams. He was one of the Bush Justice Department guys, and he felt he kind of got screwed under the Obama administration, and then he's has to go out after these folks who are, the whole thing is just, it would be silly if it wasn't so sad.
Yeah, and it's more of that frame of, we need to be afraid of the black guy.
Well, yeah, and you know, I'll tell you something. That's one of the scariest things about this whole cycle. I mean, if we could talk about, you know, what, you know, all, we could talk about the machines that didn't work and
we will.
Registration problems, and we could talk about, you know, like the politicization around voter ID, but the notion that it was permissible to basically go after black and brown voters in all kinds of, like, not entirely subtle code was really a big-time Republican thing, and it's pretty darn ugly, and there you go. You know, the Fox thing is like a perfect poster of it.
But hasn't that been, I mean, isn't this stuff we've been talking about for years? I mean, it's that dog whistle politic, and I guess you could go back to the 1976 election when Reagan coined the term welfare queen. I mean, we've been using that dog whistle frame for years.
Yeah, well, Newt Gingrich, when he came out and said, you know, the food stamp president, I mean, I mean, you forget about the primaries, but there that was. But, you know, what it's really about, of course, is that the Republican Party, as of being the party of white, rich people and retirees, you know, they do not have, their base is shrinking. They know it. I mean, if you look at, like, what's really going on behind these, like, redistricting decisions in Texas and, you know, why would a state like Kansas go crazy over voter ID? It's because, you know, they're not white anymore. And states like Texas will become Democratic in, you know, 5 to 10 years because of the Latinos. And, you know, and they don't want to let go. It's almost like, almost like the South, you know, before the Civil War, right after Reconstruction stopped.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at Pennsylvania. I don't know if you've seen a map of our congressional districts, but, you know, Obama won the state by about 5%. You had Casey, who won easily, won re-election easily. And yet only 5 of the 18 congressional districts went to Democrats, all because we've got a very nicely gerrymandered state.
Well, and that's the situation, you know, in state after state across the country. And, you know, there are all kinds of very interesting articles today about people who are saying, well, you know, if the districts were a little more fair, we really would have a Democratic House, and we should. And it's, in some ways, it's kind of hard to argue with that.
But, you know, at the end of it, you look at this election, and then I go back to all of the voter suppression tactics across the country. And, you know, I often play the clip of Paul Weyrich, you know, the guy who is the founder of the Heritage Foundation, where he said this.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
I mean, I don't know how you can argue with that's the game plan, and that was 1980. They've been pursuing this agenda since 1980.
They have, and it's changed slightly. But, you know, this cycle, well, since 2010, since the sort of Tea Party insurgency, if you will, you know, it was only at most 20% of the, you know, electorate. It's been just a flat-out gaming of the rules to basically, you know, put, you know, just trip people up so they just can't get through the polling place door. But, you know, the thing that's really important to remember about this is that Democratic lawyers, progressive lawyers, and voting rights folks who believe in participation won like 90% of the lawsuits this summer. I mean, they beat back voter registration drive restrictions in Florida. They brought back early voting in Ohio. They brought it back in Florida. They stopped voter ID in Wisconsin, you know, and in your state, you know, very, very importantly. And then the Justice Department came in and they stopped ID in South Carolina. They stopped it in Texas. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And go back a year, people were thinking, oh, my God, you know, the Republicans are going to just – I mean, they tried their best, and we did a lot to push back, and you know, and the courts were largely sympathetic.
And largely conservative like they are here in Pennsylvania. And that's the other part that really kind of surprised me.
Well, it is surprising in some ways. In other ways, it's not. You know, it sure is important to have fair-minded judges, and there sometimes are not fair-minded judges. I've really come to realize that a lot. But on a lot of these election law cases, they were fair-minded. The fellow who first made that decision in Pennsylvania about ID, who came back before his court, he was really called on the carpet by your state Supreme Court, and for the right reasons, by the way.
Yeah. The problem with that is this is a battle that's going to be fought next year because the voter ID was not taken out. It was just shut down for this election. So the fight will continue in the next year and beyond. And a lot of the problems that we saw this cycle, we're going to see and enforced next time.
Well, that is true. But, you know, one just hopes that, you know, one just hopes with like the Justice Department doing what the Justice Department does, and perhaps being involved, that, you know, these laws will be, they'll be better rather than worse. And I don't know what can I say?
Right.
I mean, you know, this stuff just goes on and on and on. But you know, there are a lot of other problems in the voting system, with voting, that it's a really big landscape, and it's far too complex, and kind of like everywhere you look, there are big problems.
I mean, for instance, you know, I got a couple of robocalls telling me, well, you know, your polling place has been changed. I had a door hanger that said my polling place had been changed. You know, I've seen reports of robocalls of, hey, you know, your election's been changed till tomorrow. A whole bunch of nonsense that, you know, none of the people who are protecting the sanctity of the ballot box seem to be all that concerned with.
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of deceptive stuff. And, you know, and that's, well, what can I say? It's obviously, you know, meant to be deceptive, and we hope that people aren't fooled by it, and it's discouraging, and people never get caught doing this, or almost never get caught. Just like, you know, people who put up the, you know, the blatant lies in campaign ads almost never get caught on, you know, in the last 48 hours or 72 hours of a campaign. Very rarely. You know, and, you know, but the other thing is, you know, I went through about 3 hours worth of the election protection reports from Pennsylvania on election day, you know, yesterday afternoon. And what I saw was two big things, really. I saw voter registration system problems that didn't have people, you know, listed properly. And that's a government bureaucracy thing. And I saw, you know, all the partisan stuff around voter ID. That is a completely political thing. And there were isolated reports of some of the machines, the electronic machines, you know, flipping who you would select for president.
Right.
And that's largely a calibration issue, because, you know, the technology's old.
Yeah, well, I'm not a voting machine person myself. I think the best way to cast a ballot is on a piece of paper with a pen. This way you can count it. You look at it, go, yeah, that's who I checked. That's who it is. And it, maybe it takes a little bit longer to count the ballots, but at least we've got it right there.
Yeah, well, that actually is the gold standard, so to speak. And the reason it's the gold standard, to be very clear, is that if you have a recount, you have a paper record that is a legal document. It's not computer printout, it's not a tape, you know, register like receipt. It's signed by the voter. You can go through it one by one, and you don't have to fight about something. Let's fight about something one by one. And you know, what's happened in certain states that don't quite trust the voting machines that are out there is they've bought other machinery to sort of independently do a second, you know, scanning of those ballots, like in Florida.
Right.
So there are ways to have better technology, and the last time Congress spent a lot of money on every 10 or 12 years they pass a major voting reform bill. And the last one after Florida in 2000 came in 2002. And so we're sort of on track to take a pretty big look at voting issues, whether it's machines or voter registration or voter ID or just, you know,
or these insane lines. I mean, you know, I saw stories, people standing in line 6-8 hours, you know, back in 2004, people were standing in line 10 hours. You know, that's just unconscionable.
Well, it is unconscionable, and if anything, that tells you how much of a mandate there is from people who want to vote and deserve better. I mean, you know, we really need a 21st century process from top to bottom, and I'm not trying to disparage election officials who I find in many cases, I'm not talking about the politicians up top, but the civil servants who are trying to do the job. In many cases, you know, they believe in participation, that they are patriotic, and they try to be nonpartisan. But they have lousy gear. They have politicians who write rules that create the lines. Do you know why there were lines, you know, 9-hour lines in Florida? Do you really know why they were?
Why?
It's really simple. Because the state legislature said you could only have early voting in a very small number of locations. A limited number of locations.
And well, it goes back again. You know, I mean, it goes back, Stephen, to what we, what Weyrich said. You know, you need to hold the number of votes down because you know he knew his side wouldn't win if you had more people participating. And I think the Republicans, especially the conservative ideologues, understand that if everyone has access to the ballot box, their conservative ideology fails across a broad spectrum of the population.
Well, yes. I mean, the governing class wants to keep governing. And in a lot of these states, I mean, you can call it Democratic, you can call it Republican. It's, you know, it's mostly Republican that's doing this whole voter suppression nonsense.
Right now.
I mean, yeah, right now. I mean, you know, you can go back 50 years and it was the Southern Democrats, but that's historical. But it's the same tactics. They just have a modern, they're just dressed in modern clothes.
So how do we, you know, how do we fix these problems? I mean, like here in Pennsylvania, we leave the biggest decisions of our nation and our state up to 13 hours on a Tuesday, in a cold month. You know, how do we expand this? And I keep saying I'd love to see, you know, early voting a month in advance. I'd love to see mail-in ballots used more. Any way that we can expand folks' right to the franchise, to me, is a step in the right direction.
Well, I do agree with that. And, you know, what's happening is there are some interesting efforts out there. They're not coming from government because the money's not there. But, for example, I know people at the Pew Center on the State. And what they're doing is they're trying to help states create data centers where they draw up lists of eligible voters based on other information, voter information, other state databases. And then they have the whole list of people, all the people who should be registered, and the states will have to decide what to do with that list. But it changes the burden of registration from individual voters to basically the state. And that's what Canada does. And, you know, and they've been working on that for a couple of years, and they should be coming out after, you know, early next year with like a half dozen pilot states that are trying to do that. So, you know, that can be done. You know, then in terms of, you know, the whole ID stuff, you know, it's really absurd. You know, there are, the idea of voter impersonation fraud is a made up problem to create barriers with the police, which is what the Republicans are doing. But the truth is, is that people can be assisted to get IDs if they don't have the ID.
Right.
But moving beyond that, I mean, getting into the polling places, you know, there should be more forms of voting. You know, we believe in secret ballots, so you can't have internet voting because you can't have a unique identifier like going to your bank account online and have a secret ballot. You can have one or the other. You can't have both. But, you know, you can vote early. You can vote by mail. You can, you know, turn in like an absentee ballot at a polling place. You know, there are a lot of ways to do this so that working people don't have to, like, miss work. You know, there are a lot of ways to do this, and a lot of states do that.
Yep.
You know, and in fact, in California, where I am, it's pretty much been a shift over the last dozen years from polling place voting to early voting. Now it's about 50% or voting by mails, which is sort of a synonym. And, you know, there are ways to do these things that really make it more convenient for people. And if it's more convenient for people, then more people will do it.
But that's the problem. If it's convenient, more people are going to do it, and that is a negative for certain ideologies. And that swings over time, and there are going to always be one group or the other who wants to hold that down. But like you, I want to see it expanded.
Well, we have to expand it because the truth is, well, we have to do a lot of things, you know, to sort of restore our, like, the democratic process or make it healthier. But the fact is, when more people participate and feel they have a stake, then there's more accountability. And maybe we'll have some more debate.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm okay with, like, having a debate and losing if I feel like I tried my best to bring my point across and the other person just did a better job. I mean, it's like a football game or a baseball game or something. You know, you do your best and you accept the results. Everyone's playing by the same set of rules. But we sort of have... We're moving away from even that ability to have those kinds of discussions. You know, we're in this culture, you win, you rule, and, you know, and that's, well, you know what that is. But, yeah. But you know, there were a lot of good success stories to talk about. I mean, I read this piece we posted on Alternate Today. I found it. You know, Obama wouldn't have won Ohio were it not for, you know, for a lot of, you know, labor organizing, kind of below the radar. You know, and that's a pretty strong response compared to what happened in Wisconsin with Scott Walker. I mean, you know, people do want to have a role. They want to care and they want to make a difference.
And that's what I've been saying. We need to keep people active and engaged, informed, and pushing the middle class, working class agenda. Again, the piece alternate over at Alternet, Chaos, Disinformation, and Glitches Plague Key States, Our Broken Election System by Stephen Rosenfeld. Stephen, it's been great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Oh, well, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks. Let's take a quick break back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I know that this story might make you tear up, so now would be a good time to reach for a tissue. It's about Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of the Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs. Ready? He only took home $12 million in pay last year. To grasp the terrible sadness of this, you should know that Lord Lloyd hauled in more than $68 million in 2007, the year prior to Wall Street's crash. So, see, you'd be down too if your pay had been cut by 80%. But don't feel too badly for Blankfein and his brothers of the street, for look, a rainbow is beaming across their dark financial sky. And we know what's at the end of that radiant arc, right? Yes, a pot of gold. And the happy news is that the annual pay of Wall Street bankers this year is back up to near record levels. The base salary of all the minions of high finance now averages nearly $400,000, up 16% over the last 2 years. Hey, who says these are hard times? Of course, up in the suites where bankers-in-chief like Blankfein reign, the base pay is much sweeter than average. Plus, base pay is the least of it, for at year's end, it's bonus time. This is when multiple millions of dollars are stuffed into the pockets of the street's elites, and this year is expected to produce a bonus palooza. At last, then, it looks as though Blankfein will overcome the sadness and embarrassment of last year's $12 million check. And who could be more deserving of such a felicitous ending? After all, he labored diligently this year to eliminate 3,200 of Goldman's lower-level employees as a way to save money in order to pay top dollar to Goldman's top bankers, such as himself. This is Jim Hightower saying, so now Blankfein will cash in. Now, that's really something to cry about.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show.
Someone will tell the GOP that Ohio's not for sale. So we're singing, hey, John Kasich, don't sell us out. Hey, Ohio, stand up and shout.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So if you listen to the president's victory speech last night, you know, basically what we've been saying on the program for the longest time, you know, look, at the end of the day, the role of citizens in this country and our democracy, it doesn't end with you casting your ballot. You need to stay active, stay engaged, and push. And I think the next couple of months especially, we're going to need to be pushing to make sure that Social Security isn't under attack, that we don't see taxes go up for the working people of this country. Anyway, I've got Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened in Ohio last night. Bob, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, I love that. Where did you get that clip you just played? That's hilarious.
That was from the SB5 fight back, when they were when John Kasich said that, you know, you public sector workers, either you get on the bus or we're going to run over you with it.
Yeah, right. All right.
Yeah, the bus kind of backed over him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But, you know, hey.
Well, last night the bus backed over Mitt in Ohio. So, it, you saw Karl Rove's meltdown on Fox. I was actually talking to Ellen Ratner on the phone, and I saw what he saw, which is Hamilton County, the Republican area, still had one-third of the vote out. But what Karl, and he must be slipping, because he was good at numbers, but what he didn't realize or forgot, 4 years ago, the president won that Republican area, and he was heading to the same number. So once I saw that where he was at with two-thirds of the vote, there was no way Romney was going to make that up there. And that's a traditional, you know, silk stocking Republican area.
Yeah. Well, how much of that do you think was just he hates to lose?
No, I think Karl slipped.
Okay. All right. I was going to give him the benefit of the doubt of just, you know, being one of those people who, you know, going to fight to the last breath. But
no.
You're going to go with the slipping.
I think he's slipping, yeah.
But, hey, you know, a lot of people slipped. I mean, there were a lot of predictions that, you know, I mean, Dick Morris, oh, it's going to be a landslide. Not so much.
I didn't get that one. I thought it would be, if Romney won, I thought it would be 51%. You know, the president's won with 51. In Ohio, I thought it was, in either direction, it would be around 51. But it was a weird map. The traditional Eastern Democrat area, Romney, he got a cold message out there. It did. It took effect. Romney won the traditional Democrat rural counties. But President Obama did better than he did, by the way, in Cuyahoga, Democrat county, by a point, and better than he did last time in the traditional Republican Hamilton county. So, you know, he picked up the numbers there. But, look, the ground game, I don't care what anybody wants to say, the ground game of the Obama campaign was dynamite.
Yeah, it was better than the Romney campaign. Because I look here in Pennsylvania, I don't think I ever saw, here in Harrisburg anyway, I don't think I ever saw anyone at the Romney headquarters. They had the second floor of this one building with stickers all in the windows, but never any lights on and never anybody there.
I had friends, and it was at 3:30, and their phone rang, and then it rang again, their cell phone, and had they were talking about, please come volunteer for President Obama. And so that was even going on at 3:30 on election day.
Yep.
Good ground game.
Yeah. And what I as I was driving home last night after it was all over, Fox News on the one station here was saying that, he had the state of the art. He had the best digital campaign. You know, he had people out there making phone calls and knocking on doors. And I go, did I miss something?
Yeah. Well, it's a good grassroots campaign. He ran ads that were effective. Also, the president ran against Romney in Ohio, and Romney ran against Romney in Ohio. I mean that. When he could have seized the opportunity to bring it back to the economy, he brought it back by getting in a Jeep controversy.
Yeah, what was about that? That was an argument that he, and I said from the beginning, he can't win this one.
But also, when you're looking at it, look, oh, yes, the cars are important to Ohio, Rick, but as you know, it's not the entire ball of wax here. With the very diverse states, almost like five little states within one. So he picks a Jeep argument in which Chrysler comes out, a business, a corporation, and says, no, we're not going to do it. Now, if they lied, I mean, who knows 10, 15 years down the road, but if you're looking for votes in the state of Ohio, and you can talk about, you know, high-tech industries, some manufacturing, coal, steel, you don't take a Jeep controversy, well, create a controversy 10 days before the election, and that's all they talk about.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't do it.
That really, I think that, and some of my friends in Cleveland, they said the same thing. That really swung the vote. That really took the air out of the room, if you will.
Yeah, it hurt. He didn't get the message out. And plus, like I said, the ground game of the president. It was a tight vote, but very interesting how the state went.
Yeah, so, it was an early call as well. But, you know, I look at this, and from today forward, you know, where do we go? I saw John Boehner came out today. Didn't look like he was talking compromise, but if you listen to the words he was using, doesn't sound like there's going to be any change from the Republican side.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of, quote, lines in the sand out there. You know, Harry Reid was talking about a mandate today, and Boehner's Some of the Tea Party members of the House Republicans were talking about this is time to get aggressive now, you know. And so you got your House and Senate talk that's out there and lines in the sand, et cetera. But, you know, the president, I think, I believe, will take a three-month opportunity here, I really think, to do an honest outreach to say, hey, guys, we're going over the cliff, and what do you want to do about it? I really think that he'll see that opportunity and, you know, rise above some of the ingrained people. Look, just because the House went Republican doesn't mean it's a mandate to do as you please. That can change in 2 years.
Yeah. You know, well, I look at here in the state of Pennsylvania. I mean, Obama won pretty soundly here. Casey won pretty big. And yet, I think there were only five Democrats that won congressional seats. And I give credit to the state legislature for doing a very nice gerrymandering job.
Yes, the gerrymandering. You know, we had an issue in Ohio, went down big to create a fair redistricting, but that didn't pass.
I mean, at some point, if you look at the votes across the country, Democrats across the country seem to have more. They had more votes, yet in the House, it didn't play out that way. I mean, the statewide elections they do fairly well in, but you know, you get into those little pockets that have been nicely crafted with the Rorschach tests there, and kind of makes you wonder.
You know, redistricting is tough. I was through it many a time, and you know, one time they carved my house out from under me, the Republicans. Yeah, seriously.
You know you're not making any friends when
I wasn't
carve
friends
out
with that speaker. Yeah.
When they carve out your house,
yes,
and put
sir.
You on the outside of it.
Yeah.
Wow. As we go forward, I mean, you've been in these fights in the past. You know, what should we be looking for in the days coming? I know the first couple of days we're going to see some posturing and, you know, they're going to be chest thumping. But most of the stuff's got to be hammered out behind closed doors. And they almost have to do something, right?
Well, they should. They almost have to. They ought to. I think they're going to just, at the end of the day, thump the chest, do this, do that, posture, and extend the thing.
Yeah,
they created it, they'll extend it.
Yeah, I mean, aren't there some simple solutions that you could get out of the way right away? I mean, like extending the Bush tax cuts for the vast majority of people and say, you know, okay, we can fight over the higher-end tax cuts and, you know, do something with the alternative minimum tax, you know, so that, you know, the folks in the middle class aren't hit by it, so you're not pulling money out of the hands of people who are actually stimulating the economy?
They could do that. They could raise, look, I voted, I don't know how many times under President Bush to raise the debt ceiling, and you didn't hear a whimper. Boom, the vote happened, everybody went to dinner.
Yeah.
They could raise the debt ceiling, give themselves a little bit of cushion, with some type of date that, you know, puts a stop to it. I mean, they can agree to sit down and disagree on some things is what they can do.
Yeah.
And at least get the process going. I think they're just going to extend it temporarily. Honestly, Rick, I just don't think they're going to do a dark thing.
Just push it down the road again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as we come, as you said, the debt ceiling, that's going to come up before the next inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be another one of these cliff moments, or do you think the president will just say, you know what, we're just not going to do the whole debt ceiling thing? Because I don't understand why we even have it. I mean, if you have bills you have to pay, you got to pay them, right?
Well, the debt ceiling was to, quote, be responsible. If you want to spend more money, you have to be accountable on the vote to raise the debt ceiling. But, Rick, it was a routine thing when I was there. I mean, it just had no controversy to it. All of a sudden, when I saw this controversial, you know, in the last couple of years, I thought, where did that come from? It used to practically raise unanimously.
Yeah. How much of it do you think is the Grover Norquist anti-tax stuff, all of that?
I think that Tea Party had a big play into it, and, you know, everybody wanted to stop and draw a line in the sand when the stimulus bill came. So I think that all came into play with it.
Yeah, I see. Me with the stimulus thing, had they couched it in terms of national security? We need to, because if you listen to Romney, and I kept telling people, he's talking about massive stimulus. He's talking about massive. He was talking about, you know, we need ships and we need bombs and we need the war machine. That's a stimulus package.
Yeah, well, he would have done it through the defense, because that's part of the problem. The Republicans have to quit one. I call it defense gaga. They have to quit it, because a lot of true conservative Republicans know that defense, there's some wasteful spending in defense spending.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes over the next couple of days. Bob, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
We'll see you. Bye-bye.
Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
We got this question. What makes a rooster decide to crow? The answer from scientists is that it has something to do with an alarm clock.
A rooster crows because he has an internal clock that helps him anticipate sunrise. Like all birds, roosters sing or crow in a daily cycle. Almost all animals have daily cycles of activity, circadian rhythms, that roughly follow the cycle of day and night. Roosters anticipate sunrise to get a head start on their daily hunt for food and defensive territory.
But if one rooster in the neighborhood has an internal clock that's set a little early, he can stimulate other roosters to crow early, too. The rooster's sunrise song is actually a way of establishing his territory. When a rooster crows, he's sending out a signal to other roosters that if they trespass, they're asking for a fight.
A rooster will often crow from a vantage point above his territory, so he can make others more aware of his presence, and so his songs travel farther. Even though roosters are the most famous crooners of the chicken world, hens aren't exactly silent either. When a hen spots a hawk, she'll let out a harsh squawk to send her chicks into hiding. But if she sees a less threatening human, she might just cackle. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Got to look at that, the auto rescue, as one of the main issues here that the election. I don't know how you get away from it in Ohio. The fact that, you know, Romney, and I know we're rehashing a little bit, but the fact that he came out to let him go bankrupt, you got to know that was one of it. And the whole thing with Jeep, for me going forward, I'd like to keep talking about that Jeep issue, because I think it's important that you talk about, you know, how do we rebuild domestic manufacturing? How do we... How do we have a manufacturing base that is going to produce what we need, i.e. our military-industrial complex? I mean, if we're going to be the war machine, shouldn't we be able to produce it? And I know there's the Berry Amendment, but do you know how many exemptions we give out every year to the Berry Amendment? I'm hoping Obama read the Department of Defense's report of a couple years ago that said there are thousands of things that, well, we used to make, but not so much anymore. That we've allowed these Chinese companies to come in and, well, crate up our companies and ship them back to China so that their people have jobs. And look, I'm not against the workers over there having jobs. I am against this idea that we're going to move facilities like Sensata Technologies. That, and you know, to me, that was kind of a slap in the face. That we were going, that Bain Capital decided the day before the election that that would be the day that they would up and move that company, up and move to China, and lay all of those people off the day of the election. So that the folks go and vote, next thing they do is file for unemployment. And as I said, you know, up to the election, Romney could have been the hero. He could have swept in there and said, no, I don't want Bain Capital, the spawn of my loins, to move this company over to China. Wanted to stay right here. You're wildly profitable. Profits quadrupled. They wanted more. And for me, this Jeep thing, you know, and I go back to this because, You know, for years I've been saying we need to have domestic manufacturing policies. We need to base what's on the shelves on where it's made. Thoughts? You know, I look at this and, you know, it makes perfect sense to me. Because then everything else falls in the line. Everything else fixes itself. Our deficit problems, our debt problems, all of the unemployment problems, it all fixes itself. Because the things that we're consuming, we're actually producing. And we've said this before. You know, the reality is the job that you may save by buying American products, it may be your own. But globally, and, you know, this whole neoliberal experiment that we've tried for the last 30-odd years has failed. People like you and me. Now, it's done wildly well for the 1%. It's done wildly well for the global investor class. They've done marvelous. It's the workers. It's the people who toil in the factories in exploitable conditions. Those are the people who are getting screwed. And I know we were told when NAFTA went through that, oh, it's going to raise all ships. Oh, we're all going to do better. It's going to bring the Mexican standard of living up, and we're going to be just fine, and we're all going to be prosperous together. It hasn't worked, has it? What it's done is it's made Mexico fall further into debt and despair and desperation, and it's pulled us along with it. And we're still not producing domestically. Because what happened to those jobs that went to Mexico? Well, most of them ended up in China. So for me, you know, this discussion about the grand bargain, this discussion about the fiscal cliff that evidently is coming, it's going to fall right on our heads. Should come with, you know, our trade policies. You know, we've talked about GDP in the past. You know, they keep saying, well, you know, our GDP is down. Well, you know what? Our trade deficits have been up. You know, had we not had that negative of the net import gains, our huge, massive trade deficits, our GDP would be much greater. Because it's, you know, GDP is calculated pretty simply. Consumption, government investment, and of course, let's not forget our trade scenario. Either export or import surplus or deficit. Yet, since 1975, as a nation, we've had trade deficit after trade deficit after trade deficit. And while one of the things that caught my attention with Romney, and it was just rhetoric, was, well, he's going to label China as a currency manipulator. That would help maybe a little bit. At the end of the day, we've got to be asking, like Ross Perot said during the 92 debate, we need to go to these countries that we have trade deals with and say, you know what, we'll take what we've been giving you for the last 30 years. It's time to renegotiate. And think about this in a different light. Which is, how do we make sure that the jobs that are being created, and I heard a lot about jobs during this election cycle. The jobs that we create, what kind of jobs are they? If you listen to the Republican primary, you know, the Bachmans and the Rand Paul and the Ron Pauls of the world say, well, you know, we don't need minimum wage. And, you know, basically the idea that when I took economics about 10 years ago, which is a complete difference from when I took economics at 18 and when I took it, you know, in my 30s. The world of economics had changed to where, you know, back when I took it when I was 18, they were talking about, well, you know, how you get money into the consumer's hands and you get, you know, demand spirals the economy. And then you move to this whole supply side nonsense where if we give huge tax cuts to the wealthy and we can make workers work for pennies on the dollar, that's going to spur the economy. So if you remember the debates, you know, you have the Michelle Bachmans running around saying, well, we should do away with the minimum wage because, hey, if people are willing to and desperate enough to work for a buck an hour, yeah, absolutely. And I guess you could make the argument that, you know, if we had a desperation class of people willing to work for a buck an hour, that we wouldn't have unemployment problems. The problem is would they be able to survive? And is that the kind of country that we want to have? So as we have these conversations, which have to happen, and I'm hoping that the president with this election steals his spine. I'm hoping that the Democrats, and some of the responses I've seen from Harry Reid saying no more debt ceiling games, just raise it. You know, it seems to me to be a step in the right direction. Maybe Harry's going to grow a set. I don't know. But the hope is that, you know, you say, look, you know, we won the election. The exit polling is clear. 60% of the people who coming out of the polls said, look, we should be raising taxes on the folks who have it to raise it on. We shouldn't be slashing Medicare. We shouldn't be fiddling with Social Security. We shouldn't be destroying the safety net that saved this nation from depression in 2008. The simple fixes to these problems, and there are simple fixes. To me, Social Security is very simple. You just take the cap off. And I would even say lower the rate a little bit. That would be a stimulus. That would get money into working people's pockets. And then they could in turn spend that. It would help the economy because then it would create some jobs. Because that's how you create jobs. Spending. Austerity doesn't work. This idea of strangling somebody because we want to get more air into their lungs doesn't work, which is basically what we're doing with austerity. Medicare, a very simple fix. Open it up to people like me. Open it up to the younger folks. Open it up to everybody. Expand the pool. Just don't insure the sickest people in the country. That's the problem. The problem is we, the people, we as our government have said, well, you know what? Insurance company, you can pick and choose. You get the healthy people. You get the people who have jobs, who go to work. We'll take care of the folks who are on disability. We'll take care of the folks who are at the end of their lives. We'll take care of those children as well. And study after study has shown, you know, people use health care predominantly in the first 5 years and in the last. And yet we have decided that we're going to take that out of the quote-unquote free market. Does that make sense to you? And on the tax part of this, fairly simple in my view. And it goes back to, you know, to the cave days. Not rocket science. The guy who can carry the most water, the person with the biggest shoulders, carries the big bucket. It's that simple. Those who have, we should be, if things are as bad as they're telling us, if the fiscal cliff is upon us, there's some very simple solutions to this. Question is, will those people that we put into the halls of power, because I think we've spoken, will they follow the demand, or have the states done such a good job of gerrymandering, have the wealth class done such a good job of divide and conquer and slicing and dicing us, that they're not so much worried about us paying attention? That's the question. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
I would kind of go with the free money. I think that's probably the right way, that the reason they brought it there. And to be honest, the whole reason the cracker plant is going where it is going is because that's the best location possible. And it was the only real location, because remember, that's where the gas is. Oh, wow. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. I got my good friend Jake Long here with me in studio. Jake, fresh off of the door knocking, talking to people on the street. What were they saying before the election?
Well, I believe Pennsylvania was a lot like a cross-section of the United States. You had some real concerns out there. I met quite a few elderly people that really weren't quite sure exactly what Romney's plan, what it portended for Social Security, Medicare. You talk to them, you talk to them a couple minutes, you lay it out for them, and many of those people would thank you. And they would say, well, you know, you clarified some things, and I believe that was important. I think the idea that labor, to some degree, I think especially in this state, felt up against it. They're back against the wall. As you know, Corbett has had nothing but an anti-union agenda. And I think labor going into the election realized two things. First of all, they had to carry the state for Barack Obama. They needed some friends in some key statewide offices. And they also needed to be able to put up a firewall between themselves and Corbett, either in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. And I believe in each case they've done a pretty good job.
Yeah, we'll see when they come back next year how that works out. And you hope some of the ugliness, because I've been saying what's coming up, the pension fight is going to come up, where they're going to want to steal public sector pensions, and more of the divide and conquer by saying, oh, well, okay, well, you old people, you folks who've been here a while, you can keep that defined benefit. But you new workers, we're going to screw you with these 401ks. And of course, we, the taxpayers, we're going to get saddled with massive cost, because that's the least effective, least cost-effective way of dealing with the crisis that they created.
Mm-hmm. And that's not, obviously, I know you know this, Rick, but for our listeners who are not from Pennsylvania, the governor has actually said, believe it or not, in a state that probably has a richer labor history than any state in the union, he has actually said he will sign a right-to-work bill if it comes before him. They're also going to revisit the issue of privatization of the state stores. They're going after prevailing wage. And that's just the big ones. I'm sure,
some of the workers' comp's coming back.
Workers' comp, some of the right wingers have their dream list. Thank God that labor did a good job, and we've elected some real good friends of labor, and I think, we're going to be much stronger this year.
So what do you think of this?
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Done. It's done.
I'm not so sure about that. I think the courts might have something to say to this. What do I think about it? It's unnecessary, obviously. I mean, I'm sure that you've rehashed that 100 times. Are they going to strike it down? No, I don't think they will. I don't know what your opinion is, Rick. I'm not so sure that they will change it to any good degree. I don't know the leeway that a court would have. I believe there were some changes to it that don't make it as bad as it was. And some of that was enlightened self-interest. I believe the Republicans, Rick, but several months before the election, woke up and said, uh-oh, this law might keep a lot of Republicans from not being qualified to work. I think that was part of the give back of the Corbett administration there on some issues. But at the end of the day, I think the law is going to stay.
Well, I mean, the court's decision was just for this election. The fight then becomes next year. You know, how do you push back again and make sure that we expand the right to the franchise and expand the right of people to be able to vote? And did you see much concern when you were out talking to people? Because I know you probably knocked on two, three thousand doors this election cycle?
A lot. Let's put it this way. At the end of the cycle, I was there, and I literally wore out a pair of shoes, not unlike a lot of my brothers and sisters. But there was some concern there, Rick. I'm not so sure that the average citizen really truly understands the political ramifications, but there was some concern out there.
So in looking at the people that you talked to, what was the key issue? Because I've been saying this election, what we saw happen yesterday is a referendum on Social Security and on Medicare first and foremost. They don't want to privatize Social Security, don't want a voucher plan, and it's a referendum on austerity. We don't want to see more cut, gut, and punish.
I think you're exactly right. I think that was the number one issue. I also think that they felt that we, in general terms, the country was going in the right direction, and they had some real misgivings. And quite frankly, I think Romney really had some missteps in a key time frame the last couple of weeks. I think that really hurt him.
Now, the Jeep thing just seemed dumb to me, why he would get himself in the middle of that, especially when you look at his past of being someone who has outsourced jobs to China. In fact, as I said earlier, you know, Sensata Technologies, you know, with Bain Capital sending those jobs the day before the election. It's just mind-blowing. But, you know, hey, great work during this election cycle. I know you had a good time going out there knocking on doors and talking to people, and I appreciate, we all appreciate the work you do.
Well, thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
Again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Good day. Tomorrow will be better. Tomorrow we begin the fight to take back the message and push for the agenda that, well, is going to help create that strong American dream, that strong middle class. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color and light, time and flood beneath the blood of sway, imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain.